Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999, going from Alabama to Hollywood with our husbands head in the hot box here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybar.
And I'm Philisco.
And with us, I don't know if this is dropping before or after our Patreon episode with them, but with us is Brooke, from our Patreon episode, is Brooke Solomon, Jordan Gustafson from the Queer Quatcher Project. Podcasts are very good friends. We've only met them twice. Are very good friends. We love them.
But we've been to Bruno. Oh, we've been to Bruno and back with them. Jordan,
Jordan, you share a last name with one of the great film characters of all time.
It's true.
That must be a cool thing for you.
That's awesome.
A touchstone in our family, actually. Yes.
Like of all the characters you could have had you could have shared a name with, not the best one.
Not Jordan Obi-Wan Kenobi.
No.
Jordan.
Marge Gustafson is the fucking best.
No, you got the best one. The best one. Yeah. All I have is a lawyer named Larry Nybart that was in a couple episodes of Matlock. And
I don't have anybody.
And he lost. Well, you have the director of She's All That, Robert Isco.
I do.
There you go. His
actual cousin.
There's a random character on a Hawaiian surf drama from like the mid-2000s.
Nice. Sounds
whose
great.
Name is Brooke Solomon, and I know because I was very interested in Googling myself as a child, which should tell you everything you need to know about me. And I would always be so mad that this character from some random surfing drama would come up instead of me. So
there are a lot of Solomons, though.
First names are also interesting because I feel like there aren't a lot of like Jordan big characters. So like there was that thing going around on Twitter a bit ago where it's like, four characters that have your name. And I was oh, slam dunk. Let's find some Jordans. And like the biggest Jordan was like Crossing Jordan.
I'm sorry, Jordan Belfort, Jordan Baker.
Yes. Catalano? And what about Jordan? And also Jordan Catalano. Yeah, exactly.
Catalano.
I mean, I'm not saying there's a not a lot of them, but there aren't like tons, you know, there wasn't
Jordan,
a lot to work with.
I don't remember her last name, but from
I love her.
Studio 60.
On the Sunset Strip.
Yes.
Jordan.
Everything McDear. I want to be remembered for.
Jordan McDear. Give me a couple of Kennys.
Good. Very few Kennys.
South Park.
You got South Park. That's the Kenny of all Kennys.
That's like the biggest Kenny.
The Kenny of all Kennys. I like him. He's a good Kenny.
Now, I have a question. Which do you think is more remembered, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip or Crazy in Alabama?
Definitely Studio 60.
So Crazy in Alabama as we've discussed on previous episodes, you know, we're in our last year of podcasts like it's 1999. So these movies have been on our list for 4 years. So Crazy in Alabama has been sitting on that list. And Kenny and I have often thought about, like, what are we going to do with this one? There's something to be done here. Like, this is going to be interesting, right? Like, this, and you're not wrong. Like, we just,
Antonio Banderas directed,
right,
it.
Directing, like, his wife. Like, yeah, there's something here.
Lucas Fleck. Yeehaw.
It's actually shocking how little there is here, given that there should be something.
Yeah.
Here.
But there's also like
incredible
a lot here.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's so I play this movie. What came very, very apparent to me, and I texted this to you, Kenny, because I was asking myself.
It's maybe your best observation of the podcast.
I appreciate that. Maybe it's been a long time, and this is the best. But okay, sure.
Great. Say it.
It's a very good observation.
Listeners will agree.
I pressed play on this, and I found myself asking, why did Antonio Banderas want to make this movie? And I think Antonio Banderas learned very quickly how hard it is to do what Pedro Almodovar does.
Yes.
Because there's no question that he was like, oh yeah, I'm going to do my crazy, rompy kind of thing. And I don't mean to, I'm not generalizing Almodovar as being but you know what I'm saying.
But that also has like energy. Something like deathly serious happening at the same time.
Yes. Like a melodrama, but there's like a crazy stakes and there's a lot of camp happening, but the camp is also coinciding with serious themes.
Yes.
Does not work.
Doesn't work. Even the credit sequence looks like Almodovar's credit sequence.
The color.
Bright garish colors and not just a pop of really bright color. It's really fascinating
crazy
to see
someone who, you know, Antonio Banderas, obviously not a obviously not an American Spanish guy, but like at this point in his life, like has lived here for a very long time, married to an American woman. He's an American and kind of weaned in Hollywood the last one. He's an American director at this point to some extent. Mm-hmm. It's weird to see someone who is like lived and breathed Hollywood film try to make an Almodovar movie. And how, in the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, it also goes to show as well, because like we are in a world now where theoretically it seems that Almodovar is making his first English language film with Cate Blanchett.
He is.
We'll see if that happens.
Well, sure.
I'm very curious to see what that film is, because so much of Almodovar's films is so entrenched in the language and the culture and the you know what I mean? So I just don't know how well that translates. It might be great. Who knows? But this just goes to show that the culture clash of like Southern America with the sensibilities of, or an attempt at the sensibilities of what Almodovar does in his films does not work. Like those are two things that don't work.
You know what the Blanchett movie is called?
I don't.
It's so good.
What is it?
A Manual for Cleaning Women.
Great. And great. I'm in.
It's just a manual. Is it a manual for cleaning women, or is it a manual for cleaning women? It's pretty good, and given a Almodovar's track record,
and then you think
it's
of
probably
this
the
movie,
latter.
It could be either one.
Crazy either in Alabama, one. Or is it Crazy in Alabama? I don't know. Yeah. You know, it makes you think a lot.
No, it's Crazy in Alabama. Yeah. It is a fascinating thing. Crazy. This film is a weird thing, for a bunch of reasons. But like this cast is pretty bizarre too, right? Like you've got Rod Steiger, Richard Schiff, Meatloaf, Kathy Moriarty, David Morse, and spearheading this whole thing, obviously,
Osborne.
Is Melanie Griffith, who at this point in her career is in a weird spot. Like she had a big 80s. Where, I mean, obviously she did Something Wild. She does Working Girl.
My favorite movie of all time.
Jordan is obsessed with Something Wild.
Working Girl is Something Wild.
Something Wild's favorite movie of all time? That's really cool. That's a good choice.
That's a great. With Little Shop, as we've mentioned, those are like the alternating top fours in there. Yeah.
I mean, I think Something Wild is straight up brilliant. Like, I think it's
so good.
And that is a movie that shows how to navigate tone.
Yes.
It's one of the best. And also, like, practically impossible to replicate.
Right.
Like,
100%.
So
a director who can handle it.
a real master. Real genius. Yeah.
So she does Working Girl in 88, and that is, she gets an Academy Award nomination. It's an enormous movie. It's a great movie, too. I mean, so, Working Girl, great movie.
One of the best.
And then kinda has nowhere to go from there.
Working Girl straight up is, you know, among the top 10 movies that, like, I wish I could just, you know, erase from everybody's memory.
Yes.
And
yes,
make
yes.
it myself.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I would. What was the Beatles movie?
Yesterday.
I wish I could. I wish I could. Yesterday, that movie.
Yeah,
you know,
we're gonna get a Working Girl remake. My guess is imminently at some point.
Limited series. No. Ooh.
Limited series. You know,
it has to be a limited series, and it has to star.
I would hate that. I think I would hate the updating of that movie very much.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's what I would hate. We got it. It's called The Intern, fantastic movie. Nancy,
good movie.
Great movie.
Yes. Nancy knocked out of the park. I know what a Working Girl looks like in modern times. Yep. Let's move on.
Yep.
Yeah.
So in 90, Melanie Griffith has Pacific Heights and Bonfire of the Vanities. And Bonfire of the Vanities feels like the movie that really kind of puts a bullet in her. And quite frankly, a bunch of
Bonfire at the Vanities.
That's right.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Firebomb.
Yeah, Firebomb of the Vanities. And then she does Shining Through, the Nazi thriller with Michael Douglas, Stranger Among Us. She has a remake of Born Yesterday in 93. She's great in Nobody's Fool, a movie, an underseen, the Paul Newman film, which I fucking love.
Not underseen. He was nominated for it. It's a movie. It's a movie.
It's a great movie. Yeah. And then it's sort of... Well,
and then there's Milk Money, which is like a perpetual, like, you know, HBO film. I probably seen it 50 times. But if you look at her, you're looking at her filmography on Wikipedia.
I am right now, yes.
Yep. On Wikipedia or on...
On Wikipedia, IMDb.
What you're neglecting to say, and I respect you for it, is almost every movie she made in the 90s, she was nominated for a Razzie.
Yes, I'm looking at, it's really sad, actually.
It's nasty.
She gets one for Bonfire of the Vanities, then Shining Through, then Stranger Among Us, then Born Yesterday, then Too Much, then Mulholland Drive. She's nominated for a Raspberry for this.
Which is so rude.
It's so rude. Cecil B. DeMented, she also gets, which, by the way, not a bad movie.
Incredible title. One of the best titles.
Great title.
One of the best titles. But this is all just to say that, like,
you never act with Stephen Dorff. That's just, it should always be, you never do it.
She just burned very bright very quickly. And it's interesting when you think about how much of a star, like, the name Melanie Griffith still means something.
Totally.
And yet, she doesn't have that many movies that you would be like, you gotta sit down and watch this one.
It's like two or three. Like Body Double, kind of, right?
Kind of.
I mean, like, I love that movie to death. Sure. But, like, how much of it, honestly, do you think is, like, the Tippi Hedren family power that comes with it? You know, because Tippi is, like, one of the classic Hitchcock Hollywood stars. And, like, when you come from a Hollywood family, no matter what, you're going to carry so much cachet with you. And even if you're not great, you have that weight, you know?
Well, Dakota is to some degree, dealing with that a little bit, too.
Yes.
Totally.
There is interesting. So, I mean, the other part about it is she has that, like, she had very similar to Melanie Griffith, to me, mm-hmm. was the Kate Hudson trajectory.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Where they both had this, like, incredible role early in their career where they just knocked out of the park and people are like, they're the real deal.
Yeah.
And Kate, if you look at Kate Hudson's filmography, you're like, wait, why do we think she's so special? Because, like,
well, we've talked about how Hollywood, like, we really fucked up with Kate Hudson.
I'm crazy about her, and I'm always rooting for her. I'm thrilled she's in Knives Out. Like, she's so young.
Yep.
Like, this is, we're not nearly done with the story.
But, totally,
like,
agree.
It's just, Kate Hudson, if you look at her filmography, you're just like, all right, there was Almost Famous, and then a bunch of films that, like, weren't very good, and then a bunch of films that were, like, not good at all, and then she didn't make anything forever.
Yep.
And that's kind of Melanie Griffith's, like, hardly made a film of note after Cecil B. DeMented.
Correct.
So, but again, to your point, like, I always kind of in my head, you know, think of her, you know, kind of like Meg Ryan, kind of like Goldie Hawn. Like, mm-hmm. all three of them have big names and at any moment could come back and do, for instance, like a Jane Fonda and Grace and Frankie and have their own show and be top of the marquee and it would be a big deal. And I think that's that to me speaks a little bit to, like, what star power was in the 80s. You know, what it meant to be a big, bright, shining Working Girl star, you know, have like had that kind of breakout performance.
And well, yeah, it still had cachet now.
Yeah. For sure. And, you know, we Kenny and I were talking a little bit about the John Grisham movies the other day and how all of those are packed with movie stars, right? Like every single one of them, for the most part, I would say
they are movie
star vehicles. And we don't do that anymore, really, because movie stars don't open films like they used to.
Yeah, and they also like kind of don't exist anymore versus like the ones that do burn is, you know, that have carried over.
Well, it does feel like it's interesting because like there are still some that I think can open movies.
Well, there's also like I don't know why it's happening, why Grisham's with me and Bill and Nolan. He's having little moments. You think about these Grisham movies and these Grisham adjacent movies that really were the star vehicles of the 90s. You know, that kind of straddled that populist thing, but also awardsy stuff. Those movies still kind of get made. Like, what was the movie with Dark Water got made, right? It's a great film, right? But no one really saw it. No, Ruffalo really didn't get a bump off of it. And there's really virtually no margin. Like the movie where Denzel Washington played the lawyer and had Esquire at the end of his name.
Sure.
Roman J. Israel. Come on. That's now. Right.
Roman J. Israel.
I still haven't seen Esquire. That. People love it. I got to watch that.
I have
people
not
like
seen
that
it.
Movie. But again, there's like virtually no margin to playing these like, you know, crusading lawyers anymore. And that's...
For adults, you know, too. An adult-oriented movie like that. Where it's
I do think the last one that comes to mind, and this is a weird one to pick, but I'm just for what it's worth for the conversation. But like, do you guys see Gifted?
Yes.
The Chris Evans movie with...
I actually
is crazy that you have seen this and I haven't seen this.
I definitely saw this on a plane. I definitely cried my eyes out. It's a good movie.
It's a good movie. Is that Jenny Slate too?
Yes. It Jenny was Slate. Chris they Evans, were Jenny dating. Slate.
Is this where they met?
The chemistry is sizzling. McKenna Grace is there doing the work of 25 women.
And Grace McKenna plays the little girl.
She's a little genius, right?
Yeah.
She's a little genius. Uncle has to take care of her and Jenny Slate's the teacher.
Yeah,
exactly. Yep, there you go. It's Octavia a fucking low stakes, smart, grounded.
Never saw it.
It's a good movie. Mark Webb directed it. I wish he did more movies like it. I know you never saw it, Kenny. My point of saying this is that movie opened. It did well. I think that Chris Evans in certain things can open a movie on his own.
Yeah.
I think he's one of those people that can. I think Robert Downey Jr. was a guy who could, and then he kind of made Doolittle or whatever,
We just talked about this. It's so sad because that like Downey Jr. from like 2005 through 2012 is like some of the best star power we've had in so long.
And he squanders
it. And it just goes away. Yeah. It just goes away.
Yeah.
But he also chased some weird like Oscar baity things. Like The Judge and the Soloist are two movies where you're just like...
The Judge and the Soloist. The Jamie Foxx thing.
So funny that that is literally like 2013 or something.
Like it's right it's at so the like his career. It's so Oscar baity. He's trying so hard to win the Oscar. And listen, I get it. But I also just feel like exactly what you said, Jordan. Like he had this pocket where he basically could have got anything made. And he weirdly picked The Judge. Like,
it's crazy.
So here's a question.
Yeah.
We like Chris Evans on this podcast, right?
Yeah,
everyone
sure.
Everyone likes Chris Evans.
Oh, yes.
A good message. America's ass. Boy.
Yeah.
How does Chris Evans win an Oscar? If you were Chris Evans' guy...
I don't know if you've heard about the Gene Kelly biopic, sure to be the most successful thing in history.
Is he? Is that a real thing?
He's playing Gene Kelly,
it's real. Yeah. Real.
So that's not the answer. That's the entourage answer, right? Like
that is
like,
the entourage
that's
answer.
That's like, you know, you'll play Enzo Ferrari. Now someone's actually playing Enzo Ferrari.
Yes.
A Michael Mann movie?
Michael Mann.
Yeah. It's Christian Bale.
And he's Christian Bale? And he's probably going to win a fucking Oscar.
Pretty sure it's
Bale,
yeah.
But how does... Yeah, because I don't know the answer. How do you do it?
I think you go like the Knives Out route, honestly, where you get him in like a character piece and like he's doing like a bit and it's like... And I think that's honestly how Downey could get it. Like with... I don't think he's going to win for Oppenheimer, but I think if he goes that route...
Is he in Oppenheimer?
He is in makeup. It looks so good.
He looks old and stuff. It's very good.
I'm looking this up right now.
The, if it were made today, role that Downey Jr. would win for a Zodiac.
Oh, like, of course.
That's crazy.
That is the thing. Because he in particular, to Robert Downey Jr., if he is the second lead in a Scorsese's 100 years old, but a Scorsese movie or a Fincher movie or one of our, like, I'm thinking with like Benedict Cumberbatch, like, I'm thinking with Chris Klein, like if he got in a Power of the Dog type situation and broke down his own persona, like he did in Knives Out, which was brilliant.
Yep.
He could get a nomination. Or you're right, because maybe we're 10 years away from Chris Evans, you know, finding his own little Brad Pitt role.
Yeah, like, that's what I was going to say. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's so much fun. I think, like, particularly leading, well, not only, but like more leading men do fun supporting roles because they just always have so much fun with it and it feels really freeing. And I think, like, I don't know, I think especially in recent years, a lot has been made of like these big, like, female, like, lead actress performances. Like, you are the center of your own movie. The movie is not nominated for anything else besides your performance. But, like, I love the freedom that a supporting performance gives to these, like, big juggernauts. I don't know, Laura Dern and Marriage Story even, like, where you just have fun, you can chew scenery, and you can be rewarded for it without feeling like you're, like, everything is resting on your shoulders. Yeah. Like, I think the success of this movie.
It's so funny you say that, because, like, I'm thinking about how, if you look at, like, the Chrises, I unfortunately, like, just if you look at Chris Evans, you look at Chris Pine, and even Hemsworth, how they're trying in their own ways within the golden handcuffs that they have of their careers to find these little kind of nooks and crannies of interesting things. And then on the flip side of that, you have someone like Gyllenhaal, who's doing great shit, but wants to be a fucking Chris. Like, he wants to be, like, you see him in, I think if you see him in Ambulance, Jake Gyllenhaal, I liked Ambulance just fine, but Jake Gyllenhaal is a guy who definitely wants to be an Avenger. Like, he wants to be one of those guys.
I don't feel you, dude.
I think he's like a character actor trapped in, like, a leading man's body, you know?
It's kind of best of both worlds, because he knows at this point that he can be very unhinged and lead a movie, even if it's something
smaller.
Like The Guilty or Ambulance, you know? Like, he can be the
I still think Prince of Persia is in that guy. I still think there's a guy who wanted to be a big fucking movie star and it didn't fucking happen.
I think he spit that guy out with in a sack lunch.
If I lost the Oscar for Nightcrawler, I would never act again.
You didn't get nominated.
I know. It is one of the most egregious things that has ever happened on God's Green Earth.
But I agree.
Anyway.
To pivot back to Crazy in Alabama quick moment here, the movie that we are here to talk about.
Right, of course.
I'm going to give a quick synopsis for most people who have not seen Crazy in Alabama. In 1965, eccentric Lucille Vinson, played by Melanie Griffith, murders her abusive husband, chops off his head, and flees to Hollywood to pursue television fame. You know, that old chestnut. Back to Alabama. Back in her Alabama hometown, nephew P. Joe Bullis, played by Lucas Black, witnesses the killing of a young black man by racist Sheriff John Doggett, played by Meatloaf, and is unsure whether he should testify against him. When the law catches up with Lucille, she returns home, where P. Joe is becoming increasingly involved with the civil rights movement. That is Crazy in Alabama, which opened on October 22nd, 1999, against The Best Man, Double Jeopardy, Fight Club, and Bringing Out the Dead. It would go on to make $2 million on a $15 million budget. It's got 30% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 64% from audiences, which is higher than I would have imagined. Roger Ebert gave the film 2 stars, said Crazy in Alabama is ungainly fit of 3 stories that have no business being shoehorned into the same movie. The first one is familiar, events seen through the eyes of a young boy in a small town circa 1965 who recalls the day nothing was ever the same again. This point of view could have worked with either of the other 2 stories, but not both at once. A ditzy dame snaps after her years of cruel husband, leaves for Hollywood for fame and fortune, and finds, and the second being, a local black boy becomes the focus of a civil rights crusade. It is a symptom of the movie's confused agenda, and although the outcome produces 2 trials, which is insane to say, it is the ditzy dame whose fate is settled on screen and not the man charged with a crime against a black boy. The film is a directorial debut and, spoiler, the last film that Antonio Banderas directed. He is Melanie Griffith's husband, who does a competent professional job, although at the outset, they should have realized that each of their main stories would curdle the other one. When a boy is dead in a civil rights case, that kind of takes the comedy out of the sex scene nutcase defending herself in court.
Yes.
Yeah. Agreed on all counts. Hard to fight any of the charges that Roger has leveled at this film. But I want to say this. About 15 or 20 minutes into this movie, I was sort of like, this movie's more interesting than I expected it to be. Like, I actually thought it was just going to be boring. It's not boring, but it's very strange. It's you get whiplash whenever it goes from Alabama to whatever the fuck Lucille's up to. But it's interesting.
You cut from Lucas, a little one-eyed Lucas Black being like, I saw a man murdered. And then it cuts to like her like parade across the top, her ghost. And you're like, these two things can't coincide with each other. And it's crazy.
I think the fact that like, I mean, there is obviously an effort made to link the two and that they're related and like it all culminates in Alabama. Yes. But like, clearly there's not a single thematic through line that you can lean on even a little bit. Every time she talks to him on the phone, you're like, why on earth are you talking to this boy? Who is he?
When they have that,
why does he sound like a 40-year-old man?
Yeah.
When they have the split screen conversation when she's on the payphone, and I was just like, first of all, the performances in that scene in particular are incredibly stilted. So like it really feels just weirdly theatrical and it doesn't really work. And the split screen again feels like another sort of like tip of the hat to Almodovar and all classic, that kind of stuff.
Yes.
But it's just, to your point, they're in two different fucking movies and they're literally talking to each other. You're just like, I don't understand how this is happening.
But only one of those movies has to be a movie, which is the Melanie Griffin movie.
Yes.
Which is it's more interesting.
A million
times. It's perfectly fine. Like it's, I am like, and I think I'm not alone. I'm a pretty big fan and defender of Nurse Betty, which shares a lot of DNA.
Good movie. Yeah.
There's a lot of DNA with this. Came out the year later and only has the story of Nurse Betty going to Hollywood. Doesn't also have like her nephew solving civil rights.
I'm going to shake Martin Luther King Jr.'s hand.
That was crazy.
It's wild. It's so wild because I think that there is some stuff in the Melanie Griffith part that's kind of fun. I think it's kind of fun when she, you know, steals the guy's car. I think it's kind of fun when she seduces Noah Emmerich. I think it's kind of fun when she like, talks to her dead husband and has his head in a hat box.
I agree.
That's unusual stuff. That is a Motivarian. Like that is kind of the weirdness that like, you know, at least at the end, I would be like, good effort. But now at the end, I'm like, you're gross. Like what you did with the other part of this movie is gross.
Gross.
Juxtaposing it with this Melanie Griffith thing, like destroys both of them.
Yeah.
Makes the Melanie Griffith part completely meaningless. And like what happens in Alabama, like using a black kid's death as a catalyst for a white kid's
white savior story.
Handshake. All it is a fucking, kind of a white savior, but then you have the Rod Steiger part, which is absurd. And like,
I mean,
could do a lot of stuff. He is not a judge. But
he is not a judge.
It's so funny.
I'm so fascinated by what the book must have been like.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I went on like down a rabbit hole trying to figure out. I was like, who conceived of this? Was this all straight from Antonio Banderas' brain? Like, what is going on? I need to know. So I looked up the author, and weirdly, he has like six of these books that all seem to be about the same, where it's like something wacky happens, but in the deep South, so it's serious. And that's just all of his books. And some of them are weirdly well reviewed.
Including Crazy in Alabama, which I can't believe.
Fucked up.
It's crazy.
I don't understand.
It's one of those things where, like, I mean, obviously, it's IP book thing. Maybe someone somewhere was like, we'll buy the rights to this book. I don't know. I mean, maybe it gets to Melanie and maybe she sees a star vehicle in it. I don't know. I don't think she was a producer on this. I don't really get it. But I also think, and I'm sure we've said this many times before, Kenny, on this, on the 99 pod, but like when the credits started to roll on this movie, I was like, not only would this movie never get made today for a myriad of reasons, but also a movie of this scale, a movie of this kind of like mid-tier $15 million budgeted thing, you know, doesn't really have a thing anymore.
You know what I thought, Phil, was, you know, we often say movies, or this movie wouldn't get made today, you know, in kind of a lamenting tone. I thought this is a good,
thank fucking good one. God.
This is a good one that we shouldn't make.
This is we buried this with reason. This is bad stuff.
Yes.
Bad stuff. except I do like, and I, my grade doesn't reflect it because I think that, you know, it's worse for the fact that the Melanie Griffith stuff is interesting, but that stuff is compelling. And like, you know, it's Raising Arizona-ish and it's,
you know,
it has some of that like madness. I don't know. Shame. Do you think it's
weird,
that she did have kind of, you know, it's not that it's such a great performance because it's not, I think the wig is absurd, but,
What? Wait, the wig she's is, wearing a wig?
A wig?
I kept expecting her to take it off and reveal that it was like an in-universe wig. Never happened.
Like in something something wild. I was like, oh, she'll take this off.
Exactly.
It almost like robs her from Melanie Griffith-ness.
I agree.
But aside from that, you know, like there's good shit here and she could have, like, it feels like Antonio Banderas is more into the movie as a director when it's like there's this really weird part where they have Lucille, the character's name is Lucille, they have Lucille the Little Richard song playing on the background, they started with Noah Emmerich yelling Lucille and then it like also has Little Richard and then they have I believe a desert lizard mouth it's not inspired, but it is kind of like Noah Emmerich is doing this shit.
I love a little bit of like crime. I love a little bit of like women on the run. Basically, if there is any sort of movie where a husband has died under mysterious circumstances and the woman goes into a diner in this scene and all diner waitress says something like, "Honey, I bet he had it coming." Like That's the best scene of the movie. Yes. I was very on board. I was very hopeful at that point of the movie. My hope gradually disappeared as the runtime went on.
Do you mean with a court scene that lasts about 50 minutes?
So long.
Also,
I think
take it out of it.
I need this on public record. This movie was pitched to us vaguely by you guys, and we were like, "Sure, that sounds good." I just wanna say, we did not volunteer.
Yes, you didn't pick this. No. We definitely put this upon you guys. So don't do it anyway.
Fave of mine. What do you mean? I'm a Lucas Black stan.
We are talking about Fast and Furious very shortly, so we're gonna run into him.
You are going to run into
on
him.
Our own show.
You're doing the whole.
Oh, yeah.
He looks the same in this as he does in like 10 years later.
Yeah.
He never ages.
He doesn't age.
I think he does such a terrible job in Fast and Furious 3 in Tokyo Drift. It's amazing
they bring him back, quite honestly.
It's adorable they bring him back, and that's part of why I love the franchise so much. But he.
It is family.
And even including like a guy like Lucas Black in the family, giving him a role is so nice.
It's like you're a black sheep. Someone needs you back though.
Yeah.
This dude is a regular on a fucking here he was until it got canceled. CSI New Orleans NCIS New Orleans. The fact that Lucas Black is still a working, very successful actor flies in the face of everything I think I know about acting.
NCIS. He's Will Poulter's tethered.
No,
is how I view it.
That's interesting. That's interesting.
Oh God, I feel like NCIS has saved so many careers.
Chris O'Donnell.
I was going to say Chris O'Donnell being the classic. I always think of who's our girl from Stick It.
Missy Peregrine.
Missy Peregrine doing like whatever 100 episodes of FBI, and I'm like, that good for her. I don't know why I would say good for her about Lucas.
To rewind to what you were saying earlier.
Missy Peregrine.
Oh God, about, the best.
Yeah,
about so when you tapped out of the movie, or when you expected the film to go one way and it went another. I genuinely thought that Lucas was going to go on the road trip with her.
Something
like I thought the movie was going to be about those two and this kid's crazy wacky road trip with his, you know, murdering aunt or whatever. Like, that's a movie, right? The weird part of it, and it sort of occurred to me, Kenny, when you were talking about how she has the more interesting storyline. She does. But at the same time, the movie's actually weirdly not about her. Like, it's more about, like, the mythos of her in some way and her effects on the people around her than it is actually a story of Lucille's. Like, Lucille's arc, by the way, is kind of non-existent. Yeah. She doesn't really learn anything or change by the end of the film.
It's crazy to me that she, like, gets caught for the crime of having her husband's head in a hat box. That, like, she
barely, by the
stalls
way,
right, long enough for that to actually happen.
How does it not degrade?
I was just going to say, that head is going to smell.
Yes.
It's in a fucking hat box.
A stinky head.
It goes across the desert. And it's like the 90 degrees.
The way she's caught, because they think she's trying to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, because she accidentally sort of almost drops the head off the of money. The Golden Gate
the money, Bridge. The money.
Oh, that was, my apologies. That
was the money. That you won playing wet, which is in the game you win it.
In Vegas, because there's a whole Vegas thing, remember? And she meets a driver who falls so in love with her that the driver follows her all the way back to Alabama.
I was feeling this, though. I don't know. Maybe I was just...
You were feeling Richard Schiff in this? The same year, he's Toby Ziegler in the pilot of The West Wing.
You know, I love this about Richard Schiff. It's like, in the same year, he goes and playing, like ugly guy who has to chase Melanie Griffith across the country to like sex symbol.
On The West Wing.
The dude grows a beard and becomes like America's fucking hot next door.
Connor has a fucking hard on for him.
Facial hair is contour for men. If you can grow facial hair, give it a try. It does wonders.
It's pretty incredible.
Phil, you had some facial hair for a while and you looked great.
Me?
You had a beard.
I did. It was a superstitious beard.
It was a good full beard. He looked fantastic. I think.
Well, I appreciate that, Kenny. I've thought about doing it but it's so fucking itchy. I don't understand how anyone does it.
Yeah, no, it's not great. I don't grow a great beard. I'm just lazy. That's all. But
yeah, but you got a nice, you know, there's a little bit of scruff there.
I look good head on, but you know.
but point is that Richard Schiff, who's given very little to do in this other than to, you know, basically chase Melanie Griffith around. But David Morse is a really underrated actor. I just saw him on Broadway.
Agreed.
Great fucking actor.
What did you see him in?
How I Learned to Drive with Mary Louise Parker.
I didn't know. He's the best.
And he was, they're both amazing in it. It's a revival. They've played those performances, those roles before. So they're doing it again. Cool. But an underrated guy, like a guy that's sort of, I mean, obviously he's on St. Elsewhere and that's kind of where he gets his bona fides to some degree. And then he kind of bounces around. He was in a bunch of movies in the 90s that I remember him in, like 12 Monkeys and Contact and that kind of stuff. But like just a really solid fucking character actor. And again, like not given a ton to do in this, but he's still really solid.
Yeah, he
fucking kills it in Contact. Like,
yes.
You got to play the dad. You got to sell that shit.
And he's like, great.
He's, I think, the only one who walks out of this like the least awful
with a respectable performance.
Like, I'm not going to look at him and be like, oh no, because he's at least trying, but his characters also give it absolutely nothing to do or to care about. And
he's saintly. Like, he's a perfect human too. So you're just sort of like,
I don't think he can give a bad performance. Or a performance that lacks dignity. He's a very dignified performer. Yeah. I also think he's probably really smart about the scripts he picks. You know, I've also never seen him in a position to look silly. Like, straight up, no, Emmerich looks kind of silly in this movie.
Yes.
You know,
it's early days for
him. And Noah Emmerich often puts himself in the position where he looks kind of silly.
Yeah.
You know,
and
not that they're that similar, but they could be. You know what I mean? They are like similar archetypes. They're both character actors around the same age.
Yeah.
Imagine David Morse in the role in Americans. It's not that hard. You know what I mean? He could have played that role.
He's in The Rock. I forgot he was in The Rock.
Yeah, he's one of Ed Harris. He's Ed Harris's lieutenant. He's like his number two.
You know, it's interesting because he is in another 99 movie that I forgot he was in, Kenny, but he is in The Green Mile. He does go to Mouseville.
Oh, because he's Tom Hanks's number two. He's a great number
two.
He's a great number two to a movie star. He's the kind of guy you can imagine a movie star like respecting. Like, I don't know if you guys, I don't know if you guys remember Charles Oakley. Do you know Charles Oakley?
Somewhat. The basketball player?
the basketball player. He's best friends with Michael Jordan.
And nothing
like, there's just something about Oakley where it's like, yeah, I get why. Like, Oakley wasn't the best player, but he was like a tough guy, great rebounder, and just had like a swagger to him. It's like,
yeah,
Jordan would hang out with this guy. He's got to hang out with somebody.
Jordan's not going to hang out with someone like close to his level because then he's going to start getting angry.
He loves Barkley. So Barkley was like, he loves Barkley, and that was always his like, you know, good friend because I think Barkley made him laugh. But Oakley was like his roll dog. Like, they would go and do the gambling stuff together.
Yes.
They do the bad shit together. And I think Morris is a bit of an Oakley type of guy.
I mean, next to the star power of Lucas Black, he simply has no choice.
That wattage is bright. Occasion. I mean, what are you going to do?
Who decided the plot detail where he would bend over to a lawnmower and
get a rock in the face,
lose an eye, and then people think that it's a gunshot?
But for like a minute.
What the fuck is that?
Yeah, take it up with Mark Childress?
Childress. Well, it's amazing. Lucas Black is, for context, he mows the lawns of like various, like, I think it's like the baseball field or the football field or whatever. Anyway, and a rock gets stuck in the thing, flies in his eye, loses his eye. People think, the townspeople circulate a false story that it was shot in retaliation to the Black boy who was killed. For context on the civil rights component of this film, there's a group of Black boys that want to go in the pool because it's hot, and the white people are like, no, and there's an altercation that ensues, and Meatloaf kills one of the kids.
He kills this guy. This not even that young guy, 17, by pulling him off a fence. He was low enough that Meatloaf could pull him off. He was no more than 3 feet off the fence.
He
did fall on the concrete. People survived fucking three-story falls. It was not a murder fall.
I
did not think that he died for the longest time.
I didn't either.
I was like, what is the point of this scene? Because I could not believe that it was that he had died.
It was too much.
The other guy who's like the Black Davis, David Morse, is John Beasley. He plays Nehemiah Jackson, who also escapes this movie with dignity. And you know, another guy like Morse plays a lot of guys in the military, like always seems to kind of escape his shit with dignity.
Yes.
But that's because this movie has like kind of an excellent cast of pros.
Well, this is the other thing too, right? Where on some level, there's a part of me that's like, this movie kind of directed itself in the sense that you don't get the impression that he's telling actors what, like, he's an actor director on top of that, right? So he's probably just saying to the actors, go with your instincts. You're an actor and I'm an actor and fucking do whatever. So what you're getting is this weird kind of like, there's no kind of level playing field. There's this vacillation of levels of what people are doing. They're just not all in the same movie is the thing.
No.
And that the director is the person obviously who has to have that cohesion. And if you're not going to kind of let the actors know what lane to stay in, you're going to get a performance like Melanie Griffiths, which feels cartoonish and I don't mean this in a bad way. She's actually good in this movie.
Yeah.
It's just she's in a different movie. So I'm watching Lucas Haas lose his eye in a civil rights thing, and then the next scene is her in Bewitched, and I'm just like, I don't know what's fucking happening.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's like she is actually doing what her portion of the movie should be if it wasn't egregiously different. But like you said, I think that obviously, the severity of the Alabama plotline and the fact that it all coalesces around this trial, I think, like, makes her as really the only prominent female character look really stupid and really, like, shallow and ditzy. And it really is, like, not a good look. And it sucks because there's no one for her to play off of who's, like, in that same zone as her. And because she's the only woman, it's just...
The movie is so out of its depth in every single sense. Like, she's an abused woman. Mm-hmm. That's why she killed her husband. Yet when she gives her little final monologue
testimony
about why she killed her husband, her testimony, which she does as a monologue, you know, by standing, it's mostly because he didn't like the dinner she cooked him. because they don't have the guts, and nor should they, because this movie is just not like capable of it, of like describing what it's like to be an abused woman. So right. She's like, he doesn't like my dinner and it hurt.
But then they have like people throwing like racial slurs and like doing these like very intense like sit-ins and stuff. Yeah. It's so bizarre. I also think it's insane that she leaves town because she's like, I can't say it was self-defense. And then her whole point at the trial is that she's able to legally prove in court that it was self-defense.
Yeah, I mean, don't even really get me started on just like the legality of what the fuck is happening here. Like, her lawyer, I don't know, like what her plan is. Or
that's Holmes Osborne, the great Holmes Osborne. If you listen to Dead Eyes, the podcast, he's a big component of it.
Deep
podcast lore.
It just really, by the end of it, she's giving this very emotional testimony where we're learning. Where, by the way, talk about backfilling, where basically they backfill her entire fucking character story as to why she did what she did, what was going on. But all that aside, she's got this very emotional sort of mental health testimony. You're just really not sure how you're supposed to feel about this character, about what she's lived through, about whether it's okay that she killed this man or not. It feels like they're trying to get the audience to be like, it's okay to side with this murderer right now because of what she went through. And then the judge, the Rod Steiger thing, who just like throws out the law and is just like, I'm giving you 20 years. But just kidding, I'm giving you 5 years probation.
Psych! You're like, you only have to go to therapy.
What?
So get a real good psychiatrist.
Like, why not?
I
opened this movie with her murdering her goddamn husband, then she hits the road. You have half a scene, and you don't go to Lucas Black at all, and it's a 30-minute short film, and that's
it. Lucas Black is not in this movie. I will say, though, that is camp. All of that business...
I actually texted Phil pretty early on in the movie, and I said, where's my text? I text Phil a lot.
He texted me and was like, it's kind of interesting. It's interesting that we have the QQ guys on for this. And I was like, good?
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, not in a bad way. Like, it was,
we will make anything work.
We can make it,
but there is unquestionably her storyline.
It's campy. That's exactly what I'm getting at. It's campy. And that's what I was, that's why I at the beginning, and there were moments where I'm like, I actually think this is good. Like when she was in the bar and pulls out the gun and steals the guy's car, I'm like, and shoots the gun, you know, shoots it in the air, and the three guys throw the table up. I'm like, no, this is actually good. Like, this is campy, but it's not, you know, it's not intentional. They don't quite know what they're doing, but it still is fun. It's heightened. Mm-hmm. It's silly. It's, you know, I like this. And that's the one I think I texted you guys. And the thing about this film is, like, again, we've done so many fucking shitty crime things that are worse than this, but I'm going to give this a lower rating because I'm more offended by this.
Well, because I think that it really comes down to, I mean, and Ebert obviously says it very smartly in his review, but this is one of those things where when you put these two things next to each other, they both look really bad because of the comparison that the film is continually making. If this film had been solely about Melanie Griffith's character, I think that Antonio Banderas might have gotten away with the Almodovar aping 100%. And might have been able to go full whole hog on that. And it might have actually worked because it's a tone that, you know, you can kind of have a little bit more fun with. There's a little more leeway. The camp, I think he could have done that. But when you fucking cross-cut it with a civil rights drama that you then short shrift at the end, it's just like, it's bonkers.
Yeah, and bonkers. It's like, I don't think, I mean, it is very interesting, like what you mentioned at the beginning, that like Antonio Banderas is not an American, but like has obviously is like very integrated into America. Sure. But I think that, again, I don't think it's significantly worse than like a lot of very tone death about the civil rights movement, but like the seriousness and sort of like the way that that's played straight just reads extremely odd to be like, why are you drawn to this? Like, I don't understand what you found compelling about telling this story this way.
It reads like a fucking after school special, like the way how heavy-handed it is. It's like, racism is bad. Did you know that? And then you can't cut to that to then be like morally ambiguous about like Melanie Griffith, where it's like, it's cool. Maybe murder is okay if you're being abused. Okay. And like, there is so much that you can talk about with like abused women and like how the system often will not, if it was in self-defense, actually help them, which is also super interesting. But then this movie's like, no, 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 we're going to make jokes about that. But then like this Black Death is deathly serious. And you're like, oh my God, these
But then mixed into all of this, it's interesting because you've got this Lucas Black voiceover, which is also just interminable. And feels
when
almost worse.
I was 7 years old. Exactly. You're like, oh.
It's very strange.
The last person you should ever be doing a voiceover.
So you have that, and then mixed into it, and you're sort of, when I think of like, we were talking about Grisham, and he did Southern legal stuff in a compelling, crackling sort of way that really works. And had the Lucas Black stuff had that angle to it, I still don't necessarily think it would have worked next to the Melanie Griffith storyline. But part of the problem with this is it's kind of saccharine. It's kind of patronizing. It doesn't really feel like it's invested in really anything to say. And the maudlin kind of, it just doesn't work. But
it's it's so weird and sad and stupid that for about 30 years, maybe longer, maybe to today, mainstream movies have been telling the exact same story about the civil rights era from the exact same perspective, with the exact same moral, and every single time it has been presented as deathly serious. We are serious filmmakers. And I say maybe up until today because of Green Book, but like in essence,
as we all know, Green Book did it so well.
Yeah, he folded a pizza.
I'm having a pizza. It's me, Tony Lip.
I eat pizza better than the black guys.
Hey, you want some of this fried chicken? How racist can I be?
Let me teach you how to eat fried chicken. Because what I'm saying about Green Book.
That tunnel flip you just had was like the movie.
That was fantastic. Yeah, that was more adroit than this movie.
The thing about Green Book, and I think it's like interesting, is Green Book almost plays like parody in terms of the way that non-Oscar voters received it, which is like, wait, this is what we're doing? This is what we're rewarding? Like, we got to stop this. Yeah. Like, this can't happen anymore. And I don't think it has happened anymore. Like, I think that was the last gasp. But...
maybe. Yeah. I hope so. I mean, this is part of why I think that...
I mean, maybe not on TV. Like, I do think that, like... I do think that there's still, there's still room for, like, limited series where, white people save black people from, the evils of racism. But I don't think you're going to see it in serious films anymore. I really don't.
I do wonder, though, you bring up the Oscars, and I do think that, like... I'm sure Melanie Griffith looked at this and was like, this could be an Oscar play. I'm sure that Antonio Banderas read this civil rights stuff and was like, listen, if I knock this out of the park, I mean, who knows what's possible? I think that there's that kind of, I mean, that's all the wrong reasons to make this, but like, it does feel like you have to wonder whether or not that entered their mind.
That's why people do everything in Hollywood.
Yeah, it's
also
so true.
Also
Oscars
true.
Are money.
Yeah. Do you think it was like, honestly, like, I guess this is a Melanie and career question and Antonio. Do you think it was like a them thing or an agent thing, like for Melanie, where they like see this and they're like, this could get your career on track, or like she saw it and thought that it could be a switch? Like, because I wonder, because it's so many consistent missteps. At one point, you just wonder, is it like, does she just not have great taste? Or like where does that come into effect?
Yeah, what's been interesting, one of the things that I like feel like I've learned that I was very surprised about working behind the scenes in the industry is how often the sort of like celebrity couple or celebrity relationship aspect comes up. Like, oh, can we have Maggie Gyllenhaal direct Jake Gyllenhaal on something? Right. Oh, can we have like what's the vibe for
right the packaging
like,
thing
PTA directing Maya Rudolph, like what is this, like how do we make a narrative out of it? So I think like there is extra pressure from the reps and the producers at large, or the people writing the checks, to be like, well, how do we, like, let's get the gang together.
It does feel a little, I mean, just, you know, quickly looking again at her filmography. In 98, she does, do you remember that Larry Clark movie, Another Day in Paradise, that she does with James Woods, which is kind of this sort of running on empty kind of vibe of this family that's on the run, kind of a criminal thing that Larry Clark directed. And then she's in the Woody Allen film Celebrity, which comes out in 98 as well, which was again,
it's
an ensemble. Yeah. Everyone's in it, but you know, she is one of the people in it. Yeah. And it's just, I really just think that she's kind of nowhere in her career a little bit. And you just have to wonder whether or not, you know, this was the other thing too, is, I mean, Another Day in Paradise and Celebrity are, these are ensembles, right? This is Melanie Griffith above the title, her face on the poster. Like this is the one last, although Cecil B. DeMented comes after this, but still, like, these are the last two pushes.
That was a small movie. Like this was a case study. Can we still sell you Melanie Griffith?
Right.
Would you like to buy our Melanie Griffith? And I think America said no.
No.
But I'm not convinced America would have said no no matter what. Because Crazy in Alabama sounds stupid. And it is stupid. I thought I knew nothing about this movie going into it. Yeah. I thought it was like more on the lines of the stupid movies we saw, like Tumbleweeds. I assumed like that was stupid.
Anger Horses is amazing. We could solve the energy crisis with Angry Birds, Tumbleweeds.
But like the poster for this movie kind of whips, where it's like her in Hollywood and sunglasses or whatever.
Yeah.
Like in
it's a good
colors,
poster
where you're like, okay, I can buy into this.
It and does then, seem like a romp for sure.
Yeah,
when it actually looks like a Pedro Almodovar poster.
I wonder why.
Honestly, like, I didn't think we were punking you guys. I always thought that, like, from the beginning, that this was one of the potential hidden gems.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was actually going to be something that I really was going to fall for, because, like, I'm in the tank for Melanie because of Something Wild. Like,
sure,
will always be. I think when you had posed earlier that thing with Melanie Goldie and Meg is also such an interesting question, like which one could sell more. And I think ultimately now Meg Ryan's cachet is probably so at I think moment, she of the three could like
totally
everyone but, like misses rom-coms
I
know?
Think it's been like that though.
Yeah,
totally.
No, I think
totally.
There's a reason Amy Schumer put Goldie Hawn in a movie.
100% I think it's we're on a Meg train now.
I agree,
so I'd be curious if we ever get to a Melanie. But I forget where I was going, but I completely thought that this was going to be something that I would love, because it's, we love crime, we love road things. So this is like, oh, is it going to be campy? Antonio Banderas, this relationship is so hot. We love this couple. Let's see what this movie is. And then it's just not what you want at all.
Yeah. To be fair, we didn't think you were punking.
I'm not worried about that. I do think, though, this is a real family affair movie too. You've got Dakota's first performance. Jones. Little
so
Dakota Johnson's
small.
In this.
So small.
Stella Banderas, his daughter, is in this. Meatloaf's daughter is in this. It's just like, it's a real like, you got kids, bring them on down. They'll be in this in some way or another.
We need 10 children.
It's pretty. I mean, it's cute. I'm glad that like I hope that it was a fun set to be a part of. Wild. But it is interesting that like, this was shot in Louisiana. It was shot in New Orleans, Vegas, San Francisco, Los Angeles. I mean, again, this movie's pretty expensive, all things considered. You know, $15 million for this. It's a lot of location work. Although I don't think that was the Golden Gate Bridge. But I do think that there was some real shady CG work going on there when she's like dangling over the side of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Boy.
No good.
Not great. Don't do it. But I mean, it's a weird movie that I can't say I hate it, but I agree with Kenny's assessment, which is that I probably would have been more on board with this had the civil rights storyline resolved itself in a more potent way. And that it didn't just seem like the whole thing was this weird sort of twisting itself into pretzels to give Lucille a win.
Yeah.
That's the hardest part to stomach about this movie.
I was just looking up, first of all, I want to fill you guys in on something that happened also during this. In our previous episode on Bruno that we did together, I asked my father if he had ever seen
development.
So I asked him if he had ever seen Bruno, the movie, and he wrote back, and I had just said I would recommend the movie. And he wrote back, nope, good. And I wrote to my father, I wouldn't recommend it. And I said, we're doing a podcast on it, and I was interested. He responded, I'll take a look. So I'll report back on Bruno. Oh my God.
Please report back if you watch Bruno.
I'll get him on the pod. So the other thing that I wanted to say that means nothing for nothing, that I'm just, you know, Googling random shit, is I remember Melanie Griffith being so hot in Milk Money.
Mm-hmm.
And I
remember, she is hot in Milk Money.
So hot. And I remember thinking,
she's a hot person.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's a total
hot, hot lady.
And I remember thinking that Ed Harris, who plays opposite her in Milk Money, was such a fucking old man, like a grandpa. do you know how old Grandpa Ed Harris was when he made that movie?
36.
He was 44.
Yeah.
He has 40. He has a face weathered by time.
Well, now you just saw him in a wet shoe. The Lost Daughter. And again, I love this old man.
He's great in The Lost Daughter.
He's good.
He's so good.
He's one of our funnest fucking actors. He's amazing.
Did you see the thing going around Twitter of him doing the Michael Bay when he's doing The Rock, and like he keeps like trying to do where he like looks at the camera? Oh my God, it's fucking amazing. It's like a PSM. And like people in the background keep fucking up, and he gets so mad at like Michael Bay and people. It's incredible.
That sounds right.
It's incredible.
I mean this sincerely. No one has ever looked better in any movie ever than Ed Harris of The Rock.
It's like incredible.
He looks 1,000 years old in Milk Money. 2 years later, he does The Rock, and all of a sudden, he is the handsomest man who's ever lived. His eyes are the color of the Pacific.
Yes.
Like he's so steely. His hair all of a sudden looks good. Like he just looks amazing in that movie. And I'm like, wait, the grandpa from Milk Money is now this like steely, handsome, you know,
he's super underrated. I think it's easy to say this now. He's so good in Apollo 13. I think he should have won for Apollo 13. He should have beaten fucking Kevin Spacey for The Usual Suspects. That's for what it's worth.
Love this.
I was
going to
say,
love
excellent
this
2020.
I know it's easy to say that now.
Yes.
And I'm not suggesting it's, but I also just feel like he's just such a fucking stable guy.
So
you know you're always going to get a good performance at Ed Harris.
There's a world where Ed Harris has 3 Oscars. There's a world where he won for Apollo 13, where he won for The Truman Show, which he should have won for, and where he won for Pollock, which he could have won for. Yeah. There's a world where, like, he could have gotten that. The Kevin Spacey thing was, like, a weird lightning in the bottle moment. Sure. Something just caught fire in 1995 for that guy, and people just were so in the tank for him. And he had been around a little bit. Obviously, he was in Glengarry Glen Ross, but he hadn't been a big name. Like, Ed Harris had been around since, like, The Right Stuff and had a big
fun. Also Glengarry Glen Ross.
Also Glengarry. Like, and he was awesome in that movie.
He's so good
as Moss. So.
He had kind of a slower burn, but he could have picked up that Kevin Spacey, you know, the wave, and he could have gotten those 3 Oscars. I think he gave 3 Oscar worthy performances, and I think he was the runner up 3 times.
I think he should have been nominated for Lost Daughter, quite honestly. I think he could have been great in it. And I also feel like, and this kind of goes to for a bunch of people, but like Westworld, man, it's just like eating up years of great people and just trapping them on this goddamn robot show where you're just like, I mean, I understand there are people that like the show. I'm not one of them. But when I think about locking Anthony Hopkins into a 10-month hold because it's just, first of all, what that costs, but also like holding these people, great fucking actors. Ed Harris has been trapped in this white fucking cowboy
that he's in.
Yeah, it's just like, my God. So I to your point, Kenny, I think that Ed Harris is a guy who we wasted for the past little while.
He lost in 2000, he lost to Russell Crowe, who, of course, that was a makeup Oscar.
He should have beat Kevin Spacey in 99 for The Insider.
That's what I'm getting. It was a makeup Oscar. And, you know, I mean, there are other The other performance that I love from 2000 is Tom Hanks in Castaway, but I would give it Ed Harris.
Such a good performance too, though.
Castaway is a great movie. I mean, it's a phenomenal film. I think that Ed Harris is one of those guys that I can always just, you can always count on him to be great.
Yeah.
I'm super curious if Antonio Banderas will ever direct anything again.
God, like, I don't think so. I think the time has come and went. It's actually, well, when you were talking earlier about hot people, including Melanie Griffith, I do think what you said earlier, Jordan, too, that like they are such a hot couple. It's very odd to me that this film is not a little hotter, or that it doesn't treat Melanie, because that's the thing about Almodóvar films, is that like they are very sexy. Whatever way is like in conversation with the themes of the movie, but this movie is so unsexy, and it's like you are directing your wife at a period of time when you are both so desirable.
It's like there's two decades of him being hot. Yes. It's like this is his hottest, and then the second hottest, which is now.
He's always the hot.
He's a hot man. We covered him twice in 99, Kenny, with 13th Warrior and Play It to the Bone.
Which, I hardly remember him in 13th Warrior.
He's the lead.
I know. I couldn't have. In one eye, out the other.
Yeah, no, 100%. Play It to the Bone.
Play It to the Bone, I remember pretty well. And he always looks good. I mean,
he also has. Did you guys ever see Original Sin? The movie with Angelina Jolie?
Is that a 99?
No.
2001. That's just two fucking sexy people being sexy.
My favorite genre of film.
Do you, Brooke, put him in the movie in like a bit part that she like meets this guy like on the road?
I would even love if he was in like a version of the Noah Emmerich part where it's like, great, let's have them all up on each other. I'm not saying that like that's the extent of what they can do, but like actors obviously really understand the power of like being attractive on screen and how important that like can be and how much that can do for your film. And like to sort of lean into that, but also lean away from it at the same time, and that she's kind of like quote unquote ditzy and quote unquote hot, but like it's not a sexy movie at all.
And the one sex scene is that makeout scene with Emmerich, and it's just like it's weird. Played like fucking Looney Tunes. It's like, I totally agree with you. This movie has got no pulse, it's a deeply unsexy movie.
It's very unsexy. She's a pretty unsexy character. I mean, like.
I mean, murder pretty sexy in my opinion.
I'm totally down with murder being sexy. I agree. Nothing is hotter than a woman who might murder me.
Ask my wife.
but we've had a rough day, and she wants to kill me so badly. It's the hottest thing I've ever.
She wants to. She really wants to kill you today.
She wants to murder me today. And I'm like, oh my god, I can't wait to finish this podcast again.
Every single new piece of information I learn about Kenny makes him my favorite person.
Can't wait to get off this podcast.
That's so Brooke. I'm 100% with you, and Phil knows this. Murder is very sexy.
Murder is totally hot.
But she doesn't pull, and that cold open is sexy. When she says she killed her husband, very sexy. After that, it's like she's like, it sounds almost like she killed her husband by accident.
Yeah,
she's telling people cut off his head. It's in this thing. Cutting off, like, decapitation, not sexy.
Not sexy, with an electric knife. Not sexy,
especially if you don't own it. You gotta lean into it.
No, I also felt like not seeing the head made it worse.
Agreed.
Sharon Stone ice pick in bed is
the hottest.
That's how you want to go.
Yep.
But I don't want to be dismembered after. Come on. Have some respect.
Do you like the voice? Like, how do we feel about the voiceover? Because I feel like that is such
terrible.
A choice.
Terrible.
It's horrible. So horrible. It doesn't pay off for anything at all other than the dogs.
It's so classic book into movie type thing where it's like, oh God, we forgot that we have to give our characters inner lives. We'll just throw a voiceover on top.
Yep. You think that means, I'm sure it does mean that the book is first person from his point of view.
Absolutely.
It has to be. It's, so it's, a, That is maybe the only way that the book could even retain some semblance of like being a cohesive narrative if it's all completely through his eyes.
That's kind of like a fun pitch.
It is leaning into like the mythos of this woman who like is this larger than life figure, and it's really staying like in his worldview. The problem is that like so much of this film is not in his worldview. Right. And the part that is very like omnipresent. It's not really through him.
You know what you just pitched, Brooke?
What?
And I mean this as a compliment. It's going to come off like not a compliment, but I mean it as a compliment. To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah.
Kill a Mockingbird.
No, I feel it, though.
Somebody wants that.
Southern movie, first-person narrator, child, everything seen through her eyes. Part of the movie is about this like fucking boogeyman who lives down the street, which is ostensibly silly. The other part of the movie is about an unjust person being, I mean, you know, tried for murder, then tried for rape, and then killed. And they work as a book and also as a film in context because of what you just said. It is 100% through the eyes of a child.
Yep.
And that child is learning something. And she doesn't also go and like, you know, play fucking pickup ball with Malcolm X. So it's, which I think would have been bad.
Is the worst thing I have ever seen.
Do you want to rate this, Kenny? And then we can talk about what we're doing next week.
I gave it a 25 before the podcast. I'm going to stick it at 25. I think that's where it lives for me. I think it's a 0, the Lucas Black part. I think it's a 50, the Melanie Griffith part. I think I'm being generous by giving it a 25. But I think that's the movie.
I was a little more generous than you, not much, but a little more. I came in with a 35. I'm leaving with a 30. I can't really ride for this movie. But the movie that we've been discussing, the movie that could have been or could have been interesting. It could have been more, you know, serviceable. Exactly. But unfortunately, that's not the movie that we're talking about today. But that's where I'm at. What about you, Brooke?
I'm going to be aligned with Kenny and say a 25. I think that's pretty good because there really isn't anything that I can excuse in the Lucas Black section. And I do love a lot of the Melanie Griffith section, but like we said, the way that those are in conversation with each other, doing nobody any favors anywhere. And my love for Antonio Banderas cannot help me here. So 25 for me. Jordan.
I think, wow, look at this. We're all 25 because I think that Melanie Griffith does, I don't know if she's actually trying her best. The movie's interesting the most there. But anything with Lucas Black needs to be buried 6 feet under and never come out of the ground.
Yeah.
The fact that, not to be mean to Lucas Black, but honestly, this is one of the worst performances I've seen.
He's really bad.
Really atrocious, yeah.
He's very good in Sling Blade, so he deserves all the credit in the world.
He is very good in Sling Blade.
Right. Yeah. Like, I'm not saying bad actor across the board.
Although you have said that in the past.
Except for Sling Blade. He's okay. He's okay in Fast 9 because he, you know, invents a rocket ship.
He does, and they go to space, which is fucking
cool. It's so insane. So insane.
Do you guys this movie?
No.
Do you guys want to throw it on the queer quadrant?
Yeah, where does this land on the QQ?
Literally one star.
Yeah, one
could be lower, but I'm gonna say one.
There's
star
enough for camp like Almodovar trying.
Yes.
I will say the hat box scene where all the mannequins are like looking at her. Yep. I was like, this is campy.
Is 0 the lowest you could go, or is 1 the lowest you could go?
Technically, half a star is the lowest we could go.
Given a half star
we've
before.
Definitely given them. So,
what have we given a half star?
Home Alone, but also Troy. We gave Troy half a star.
Right. Troy is pretty gay, though, isn't it?
How do you guys feel about Home Alone?
Perfect movie.
We kind of
great movie. Just not particularly gay.
Only poster I have in my office.
Marv and Harry are canonically gay.
We kind of covered it, like decided to cover it as a joke, but then we like weirdly got too in the weeds, and we were like, "What have we done?"
You guys know I'm filming this. I am straight up trying to get a Marvin Harry prequel made. I guess I have to make them gay.
You have to.
If you don't, what are you doing?
Kenny, wait.
I just figured it out.
We just cracked it.
Kenny, you're now the glad ally of the year. Congratulations.
Oh, Marvin.
I thought they were going to make them gay in the remake Home Sweet Home Alone. I thought they were going to do something, and they didn't.
They didn't do anything with that.
Marv and Harry fight into kissing scene is going to be so how did you give it a 0.5 if it's canonically
I actually gave it like a star and a half because
higher than a half star.
We were like, there's no way, and then we were like, maybe, I don't know. It was a bad time all
it was
around,
a little sweaty,
but we stand by it.
Kenny, you sort of referred to the lead actor in the movie we're covering next week. We're covering Gloria with Sharon Stone.
Yes.
The remake of the, oh my God, why am I drawing a blank on Cassavetes?
John Cassavetes.
Remade by Sidney Lumet. I'm assuming you guys haven't seen this film,
no.
But I am curious on the QQ, where Sharon falls on, because she's pretty high, right?
High. We're going to talk about Basic Instinct at some point, and I'm very excited because I think that is actually like extremely
so
fascinating, like representation, yes. And like, yes, how she got like lambasted for it is so interesting. Suffice to say, extremely high. In many areas.
So I was listening to Blank Check just released their episode on The Quick and the Dead, which is the cowboy.
Oh, can't wait to listen to that.
Fucking amazing movie. Yeah.
Great movie. She's fucking great in it. And unfortunately, it's kind of the death knell of her career in a lot of ways because it doesn't perform and
nobody
she makes choices after that.
Has ever looked hotter on screen except Ed Harris in The Rock. Outside of that,
she's unbelievably hot.
She wears chaps and a hat and shoots and guns and comes out of fire.
Yeah, she's great. She's great. But what's interesting,
cool ass fucking flick that people should be talking about a
lot. 100%. And this year, both came out in 95. And Casino is sort of the moment.
Young Leo, that movie's awesome.
Yeah, it's great. So it's great. I'm not, but what I wanted to kind of highly, which I think is interesting, is that she cuts her hair at a certain point.
Mm.
And from that point on, it's kind of short hair, kind of pixie cut thing.
I remember called her short hair Sharon. She didn't like that.
I don't remember that. I think Kenny called her that primarily, but I think that
plus one gay points for that one.
he's not an ally anymore, is he?
Oh, I'm gonna win a gay point right now. I'm going to the Magic Castle for a birthday party in four days. That's not where I'm trying to get the gay point.
and in this card.
But I looked. Have you guys been to the Magic Castle?
Yes. I live extremely close to it.
Oh, I've never been. You want to be my plus one? My wife's out of town.
I would love to.
I'll have to tell her you're not bi. Just, you know.
Yeah, no,
just straight. So she.
All right. How are you getting a gay point out of this?
That's such a good gag. That's really funny.
As you know, I was my Borat gag. As you know, at the Magic Castle, for those of you who don't live in LA, the Magic Castle is you have to be invited. And I'm invited to a birthday party there, which is a dream. You have to dress up for the event. You have to wear a jacket and ties, but because they have a lot of magicians and magicians come in all, you know, all stripes, there are other options for ties. You could wear a bolo tie. You could wear a bow tie. You could wear one of those,
cravat.
You can wear a cravat. You can wear an ascot. You can wear anything around your neck that works. There is one thing that really caught my eye that you can wear. and as a homage to Sharon Stone at the Oscars, I bought a turtleneck.
Yeah.
I'm going to wear a turtleneck under a suit jacket.
That's great. You should do that.
An incredible choice.
I bought, and I did this off Amazon, so I will lose the gay point right now. But I bought a turtleneck and I bought a red blazer. Like a maroon blazer.
That's that fucking whips.
So I'm gonna wear that to the Magic Castle and look better than all the magicians.
Yeah, you're gonna be
great. Yeah, you're gonna outshine them.
Yeah, but they might ask me to become a magician.
On the Sharon Stone side of things, I do think that the short hair created this sort of androgyny, I think, that people didn't really know what to do with. Like, I think of Sphere. I think of, I mean, Sphere's problems are far greater than Sharon Stone's haircut. But I just think that she got into this bucket, and it's just interesting. I don't necessarily think that it's, I don't know. I just think her career could have been so much
better. Right. No, you're completely right.
I think we did her very dirty as a society, and it hurts because she's so cool and she's so good at like a huge variety of stuff, and makes me a little sad.
I think the conversation around like androgyny with women versus androgyny with men as stars is super fascinating because you look at Keanu, who is such an androgynous actor, and how that gets him certain roles. But then even like literally just within the confines of The Matrix, and then you look at Carrie Ann Moss, who's also a very androgynous actor, and what her career became.
Yep.
It's two very different paths.
Yeah, it's just starting to be like women who look androgynous can be hot because of the gay community. See Kristen Stewart.
It's really interesting because I do think that like Casino should have been the skeleton key for her in terms of opening up a whole new thing. But unfortunately, it feels like she's fucking amazing and it's perfectly cast. But you get the impression that everyone's like, here's your Oscar nomination. You're never going to do anything else this good again. Here's a pat on the head. And she just, I don't think it's helped by the choices she makes in terms of the movies she does after it. I mean, she does Last Dance, which is like a bad sort of, you know, melodrama about the death penalty. And she does like, you know, treacly kind of things that don't really work. But this is all just to say that
The Muse, which sucks.
The Muse isn't great.
Goodbye Lover, which sucks. Like, she did some like,
she's in Goodbye Lover.
Yeah, you haven't watched it yet, have you?
Wait, I've watched Goodbye Lover. We did the episode already. I forgot that she's in it.
Different movie. We did. She's in...
Goodbye Lover is the one with Patricia Arquette.
She's in the one we didn't do, but I watched it and you didn't. I can't remember.
Oh, yes, Simpatico. I need to watch.
Horrible flick. She did a lot of horrible flicks, and she had short hair for all of them. And I do think she. You come in American sex symbol.
Yeah,
except. If you're Halle Berry. Halle Berry's the...
Or Kristen Stewart.
Well, that's nowadays. Yes. Nowadays, you can pull it off.
It's cool. Yes, yes.
Halle Berry always...
I totally agree with you.
...to kind of, you know...
Yes. Transcendent, yeah.
Yes.
You know, it's just... And this
I was going to say, when you got that face, but, you know, Sharon Stone's got that face, so, you know...
Sharon Stone, you know, and we talk about this in the Gloria episode, she's a fascinating, and I agree with what you're saying, Brooke, which is that she's one of those situations where Hollywood... It's not all that dissimilar to Melanie Griffith, which is that kind of put
also
in this,
went
like,
short, by the way. She went short.
Did go short. But like Melanie Griffith and Sharon Stone were both sex symbols. I think that Melanie Griffith had a little bit more of a lane in terms of being, you know, I don't want to say cuter, but there's a lighterness, a levity to her.
She didn't do rom-com.
Right. But at the same time, I think both of them were put in a box. Both of them got a fucking shit ton of Razzie nominations because they were very hot women that made a whole bunch of nerds uncomfortable.
Yeah, they
didn't know what to do with it.
They're scared.
Yep.
And I think that it's just a fucking bummer because they're really talented.
It's obvious.
So just, upsetting.
Just obsess over them. They're just too hot and too cool. I think like, I gave, maybe Sharon Stone was on the list, but there's like,
there's a reclamation going on right now.
There's just a long list of female actresses, actors, dating back probably to Rita Hayworth, but, you know, really starting with Marilyn Monroe, who were bigger than movies. Bigger, and Sharon Stone for a period of time was just bigger than movies.
Yep.
Absolutely.
It's been bigger than movies. And I don't know if we have some. I think when I mentioned this, I posited, you know, Kristen Stewart might be bigger than movies right now, but maybe not. She isn't quite there. I don't.
I throw Zendaya right in there. I know she's so
Zendaya
young,
for sure.
But like getting fashion, social,
I mean, like literally bigger than like the institution of movies. Like Marilyn Monroe is just bigger than a movie. But I think Lady Gaga is kind of bigger than movies right now.
Totally.
But, you know what I mean? But it's this like. It's this thing, and they all burn bright, they burn fast, and then they, you know, the public turns on them, and it's nasty.
It's the way that we treat like women specifically, I think about Michelle Pfeiffer all the time, who's like one of my favorite stars of all time, and it's like so crazy, the runs that she goes on and the highs and how her career is so like this, just depending on her age. And then also the fact that she doesn't have an Oscar, similar to Sharon Stone, where you're like, this is a person who has put in the work for fucking decades.
Well, Michelle's been robbed on several occasions. It feels
so
like.
Many times.
It's I mean, it is. It does feel like, unfortunately, it's probably an honorary Oscar in her future, and that's going to be how it goes. But I do think that I agree with what you're saying.
I hope
Kenny.
That happens, you know? Man. I hope that happens. I hope people can, because the honorary Oscars don't often go to like huge, beautiful movie stars.
It's true. It's true.
It's just I hope that's, you know, frankly, you know, it's a crazy thing to say, but like, hope Samuel Jackson's Oscar like opens it up to the more populist type of actors.
I agree.
Yeah.
You know, like big star personas who may not have like gotten their due.
I'm amazed that Michelle Pfeiffer didn't get a nomination for French Exit. I thought that was going to happen, especially in such a weird year. And it just
she should do what Sam Jackson does, where he stands up and he's like, yes, I should have won for Pulp Fiction, you morons. She should have been like, yeah, I should have won for Fabulous Spigger Boys, you idiots.
Well, I mean, Martin Landau should have won for Ed Wood, but I understand where Sam Jackson's coming from.
If Sam Jackson had won, I don't think anyone would have cared, would have been like bad choice. I think it would have been like good choice.
Of course. I'm not saying Sam Jackson didn't deserve or doesn't deserve, but
the real,
I'm just speaking
the
more
real
to like
Oscar, the real best performance that was not nominated and should have won is Pfeiffer for Catwoman.
Hell yes. Thank you.
Life changing.
Oh my God.
World changing.
Unbelievable.
As you were saying, like higher than movies, like Michelle's Catwoman like transcended the movie and became like a moment, you know?
A cultural touchdown.
She was actually just on Jimmy Fallon a few weeks ago and watched, and they showed the footage yet again of her, the behind the scenes of her with the whip and the whatever.
It's so good.
And she's just like, she loves it obviously, because she's like, you know, whatever, I still have the whip and that's all great. And she's just the shit. And I love the fact that like she's still kind of shy, doesn't really love doing this stuff. And I think she's great. But this is all to say that like it is interesting. You look at Sharon Stone, you look at Melanie Griffith, you see these sort of those careers are much different than Michelle Pfeiffer's career. Michelle Pfeiffer, for good or for bad, stepped away for a while, raised her kids, you know, made choices. But again, like, you know, Kenny, we've covered Michelle Pfeiffer, 9 Great Bus, Deep End of the Ocean. She's not bad in Midsummer Night's Dream, but like that's good, but, 99 was not a great year for Michelle Pfeiffer, unfortunately. But again, guys, thank you so much for coming on and talking about Crazy in Alabama with us. We can't wait to have you back. We can't wait to be back on your pod again.
I know.
To talk about
another,
you know, perhaps gay film, depending
Kenny,
on
what's the, Kenny, what's the third gayest movie of your ranking? You know, Moulin Rouge is the 5-star. You have Bruno. What's your third gayest movie?
You think my second gayest movie is a 3.5?
Kenny, what was I feel like I sent you the list.
There were two.
What was the other one?
One was Moulin Rouge, which I just felt like I had to devour. The other one I picked because it seemed like, why is this even here?
What was it?
But I remember.
We love those.
I think we should do like Field of Dreams.
Oh,
it's just like
speaking Jordan's
Bull Durham.
No, I know.
Oh, wait, we should do Bull Durham.
Either
Bull
Durham's got some.
Interested in doing a baseball movie. Ironically, the reason I was late to this podcast was because for the first time in like 7 years, I was watching a Mets game, and they scored 5 runs in the 9th to win the game. And like I was watching what?
There you go.
I was watching it with my son. That when I came in, I go, we won. That was what him showing me the final score. And it was I'm like in the process of falling in love with baseball again, which I've like just slagged for the last 10 years. And I would do a baseball movie, but like,
consider it done.
You're talking to the right person.
Yeah, Jordan is
I'm
so
just
obsessed
like,
with baseball.
I feel like, I mean, Bull Durham's a sexy movie.
Yeah.
Bull
Durham would be really good.
Bull Durham is like maybe like the sexiest baseball movie ever made, because everyone is so horny in that movie.
It's the horniest movie.
For sure.
They're like, what if we fucked but on a baseball field? Like, can we do that? Is that okay?
My family also now lives in Durham. There's a lot of history and context.
I mean,
so
listen.
Basically,
it's a great movie.
Consider
but if there's Yeah, I mean, Kenny wants to think about it. I think he's mulling over other potentially more gay baseball movies.
Well, just let us know.
What's the gayest baseball movie?
I mean, we have already covered A League of Their Own, which I would argue is like that's actually the gayest.
Probably Godzilla.
That again is like canonically gay.
Yeah,
like that's you know, I think
Moneyball, gay movie.
Oh my god,
the gayest.
What I would Brad and Jonas? Fucking Moneyball.
We're not covering Moneyball, Jordan.
Moneyball gets that baseball is like the sexiest thing in the world, and the Moneyball that it just exploits it, and it's just like we're gonna make a movie about how cool and sexy baseball is.
But it's about numbers.
You're a Dodger fan.
Oh no, Red Sox fan.
Sorry, you're Boston. Yeah, Reds. Yeah, I think. Oh yeah, I mean that movie's
Billy Bean.
That movie's pretty gay for the Red Sox, too.
Oh, it's so gay for the Red Sox.
Oh, my God.
Without that movie, we don't have that 04 World Series, baby.
This is my nightmare.
That movie straight up at the end is like, all right, baseball sexy, but like...
The Red Sox are sexy. Have you been to Fenway Park?
Like,
That's why Field of Dreams is so good, because Field of Dreams is like, we love baseball, but have you been to fucking Fenway?
I know. And like, it is true that Fenway is
it's
sexy.
The best. It's
like,
the it's fucking best.
I think it's funny because like the two oldest stadiums, Fenway and Wrigley, like Fenway's sexy and Wrigley is like chaste. You know?
Yes.
Wrigley's a fucking 120-year-old virgin.
Yeah, it has the wall. You know, it's a brick wall. It's putting up boundaries. Fenway's not fighting.
Like the brick green wall. Monster. Also, you know, covering an ivy. They do landscaping out there. They don't even care what they look like.
Fenway threw the first brick at Stonewall.
Stop!
This has devolved into madness.
You single-handedly undid like probably 60% of our goodwill.
That's not true. We can't wait to come on and talk about gay baseball with you guys. It's going to be great. Will you tell our listeners where they can find you guys and where they can listen to your podcast? Most importantly.
So we're on Twitter. I'm at Brooke B. Solomon.
Jordan H. Gus.
And we're together, the pod, at Queer Quadrant. And we're also on Letterboxd at Brooke B. Solomon.
Jordan H. Gus.
And you can find the Queer Quadrant podcast on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts. Wherever else you care to get your podcast, listen for baseball, listen for Sharon Stone. I can't name all the topics that we talked about, but we're
Melanie
there.
Griffith, civil rights.
Civil rights.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Both thrilled to have you guys on. This was a blast. It's not every day that we get to do Bruno and Crazy in Alabama back to back. It's a great thing. We can't wait to be back on your pod. We can't wait to have you guys back on. This was an absolute blast. Thank you so much.
I feel the same. Thank you.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
See you guys later.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999, fucking against a chain link fence here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybar.
And I'm Felisco.
And back with us today from the Queer Quadrant, our good friends and our first in-person guests in 2+ years. We also have Ernie back in the flesh. It's like, guys, it's all happening. Their names are Brooke Solomon and Jordan Gustafson. Thank you guys for coming back to our podcast.
I would normally say thank you for having us.
That's what I was going to say.
But I don't know if I should be thanking you about to go through.
First of all, it should be said just up front, we're pairing this episode with another episode that we did with Brooke and Jordan. For Antonio Banderas's Crazy in Alabama.
Only the best
for Brooke and Jordan.
Yes, thank you so much.
These two films just, you know, obviously a stellar diptych of things to pair next to each other. But I just want to put that out there. We brought it up to you guys that, you know, if you wanted to come on for Body Shots, a movie that got a theatrical release, barely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And a movie that I've kind of forgot. Like, there's sort of the giant list of 99 movies, which includes your straight to videos and your what have yous, right? And
not trying, really.
What do you mean?
Well, we don't
work off of that.
Yes,
thank God.
Yes.
And so this one was like on the cusp, because like I remember this being on video, but I don't remember this in theaters.
This wasn't on our list until like a couple weeks ago.
Correct.
This definitely was theatrically released.
Correct. Which is why we
had to be done.
But
for whatever reason, this is not listed on the Wikipedia list. This is not listed on whatever massive kind of repositories we pulled from.
Correct.
Which is not just the Wikipedia thing. It was like Box Office Mojo things and like anything, and going down to like the 400 or 500s. That's why we were able to do this for 5 years. But Body Shot's a movie that I actually do remember because, like, it did have a little bit of, like, pre-release buzz. Mm-hmm.
I would say also, I mean, not to, you know, I know I've said this many times in the podcast, but this is a video store movie. This was a movie that also kind of had legs in terms of people feeling like they discovered some fucking hidden gem in Body Shots. A lot of college people renting this movie and feeling like, you know, they you know, this edgy movie. So there's that too. I also feel like you texted me this about the Sean Patrick Flannery of it all.
Yeah.
And him having
rough year.
The worst 99 of anyone.
Rough
the
year,
inverse
yeah.
of Brendan Fraser's.
Yeah.
Right.
Brendan Brasher over here.
Because it's Boondock Saints, another huge video movie. Like a movie that people, a
still
lot of college bros,
somehow.
Still,
yeah.
Right? And then Simply Irresistible, a movie that Kenny
good movie,
defends
a very,
to the death.
Very good movie. And it's really weird.
Just Amanda Peet also in that movie.
I'm not going to like give too much away because, as I've said, I want to hear what you guys have to say before I dive
Defend
in.
It? Yeah.
But weirdly enough.
Yes.
It's Boondock Saints and it's Simply Irresistible that inform my opinion of this film, and it has nothing to do with Sean Patrick Flannery.
Every time you say a new thing about your opinion on this movie, I get more and more
getting nervous,
curious, scared, apprehensive.
Hey, that's my goal. My goal is to freak y'all out.
I think I understand.
No, go, please, second. Please.
I feel like I understand that. Like I know where the Nybart perspective is coming
find
from.
Find that hard to believe. It's not that
okay.
It's actually not that high minded.
This is not a high minded movie. So
no,
it's very esoteric.
It has nothing to do. It has nothing to do with. It has almost nothing to do with the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with something very simple. Very simple.
Okay.
And I'm giving it away a little bit, and I wanted to like.
Yeah, no.
I'm just gonna be
just get it out there.
Just gonna be
throw it out
straight up here.
Yes.
Boondock Saints is directed by Troy Duffy, a total idiot, borderline problematic moron who never read anything that made me give him the benefit of the doubt. Outside of the fact that he is ostensibly an artist, and I give all artists benefits of the doubt, but he lost it pretty quickly with the content of that movie. Simply Irresistible is the opposite. Simply Irresistible, I don't remember the director's name. Mark Tarvlov, of course.
Who obviously went on to
huge success.
Mark Tarvlov was John Waters' producing partner for years and years and years. So coming from the school of John Waters, you have to at least entertain the idea
that some of what he's doing in Simply Irresistible is intentional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you start to go down that road with Simply Irresistible, which is a completely bonkers movie, mm-hmm. there is at least another layer that you have to view it through before declaring this as a disaster. I think this falls into the latter category. And the reason I'll say that is the director, Mark Christopher, mm-hmm. Pulitzer Prize winning playwright.
Correct.
Tony Award winning playwright. The director of this film, the writer of this.
Screenwriter of Witches of Eastwick.
Witches of Eastwick.
Good movie.
A great film.
Not a non-artist. David McKenna, writer of American History X, mm-hmm. also a movie that leads you kind of down the wrong road before bringing you back to what I think is the right road. So at least given their oeuvres,
sure.
I think you have to at least give this movie the benefit of the doubt that it's not what it appears to be for the first half. And I don't think it is what it is. I will get into that argument later. I think it's significantly better than I think one might think on first.
I think that my gut reaction to what you're saying is that, you know, the road to hell is paved with the best of intentions.
Yeah.
I think that you're not wrong that there are some intellectual notions coursing through this film and trying to do things. I just think it fails at doing.
Let's talk about it.
I think trying is the key. Yes.
Let's
word.
Talk mm-hmm. about it. Let's talk about it.
I mean, I just like to say, like, I'll go for a ride on your jelly roll, but I won't give you nothing from my soul. I mean, it's a really, really smart way to open a film. It makes you think.
It does.
It really, you know, lays out its themes.
No, so, but I actually do understand where you're coming from, though.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I want to note, yes. Jordan, that I texted you all that. That I texted you that opening thing as a premature strike against this film, which I thought was a joke and stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think out of context, which is the way in which I texted you that, it is really, really stupid and embarrassing. what you just read. I think in context.
Oh my God, you're going to defend this?
It's not even a matter of that. Wow. It's really just like there's an argument in this movie.
Uh-huh.
It may not ultimately be an argument that has aged well.
I would say it has not.
Well, bear with me. But it is an argument, and I think there is.
It is an argument.
You're arguing.
Cannot
that
deny that
this film has artistic integrity simply because it attempts to make a point, as opposed to having no point at all.
No. First of all, yes, kind of. Second of all. Okay. Having seen so many movies that don't attempt to make a point.
Correct.
Secondly, I think this movie makes it a little more deftly than a lot of other movies. And third, I think that what's kind of critical about this film, Body Shots, starring Tara Reid and Jerry O'Connell, mm-hmm. is that it doesn't answer its own questions. So we can have this discussion at the end of the film. Whereas
that I agree with.
So many films today, and this is a big problem, are afraid of the conversation we're about to have about it, which is, what is he saying? What does he mean? Where does he come down? What is being kind of communicated mm-hmm. by the visions and by the visuals and words said on the screen? And God forbid you should think we're saying the quote unquote wrong thing, because I think the reason that it hasn't aged well in part is because he doesn't answer his own question. And I'll tell you what I think the answer is. The answer is promiscuous sex a societal ill? I think that's what he's getting at here. Is promiscuous, nameless sex ultimately something that leads to more problems than solutions? And that is definitely not sex positive. That is definitely like kind of a, you know, a problem notion in society. But I will say he lays out this case throughout the film in a really interesting way. That's all. And in a way that I don't think is as anti-progressive as it seems. Like, it's all the Ron Livingston character, the Jerry O'Connell character, Sean Patrick Flannery to some extent, and the other guy who kind of is essentially the moral compass of the film, the guy who doesn't really, mm-hmm. Brad Rowe, who doesn't really have much of a career after this. Yeah. well, a lot of them don't have characters. I'm not saying it's great. I didn't give it like 100, but I am saying like...
You did give it a 99.
I gave it a 99. These guys are all garbage, and they are all manipulative, and they are all objectifiers, and they mm-hmm. are all God. This is to me, like, I genuinely believe this is the anti-American Pie, which champions the notion that, no offense, but women are just there to lose your virginity to. That it doesn't matter who you lose your virginity mm-hmm. to. All that matters is that it happens, which is actually a societal ill.
I don't disagree with anything you're saying necessarily. I just so much of what you're saying is so execution dependent, and this film executes these ideas so poorly.
I obviously don't think so. Got across to me.
Well, getting it across and actually. I think that from a storytelling perspective,
let's do it. Let's get into it.
It's not. It's. I want to do just the synopsis very quickly, yeah. just and get this out of the way. The Los Angeles club scene is a place of booze-filled decadence and debauchery. A night of full of possibilities. 8-20-somethings take to the clubs, seeking good times, companionship, and maybe a little sex. But in the harsh light of the morning after, their worlds are thrown into a spin of confusion when hungover Sarah, played by Tara Reid, accuses hard-partying Mike, played by Jerry O'Connell, of date rape. Loyalties are tested as each among them is forced to take sides. Body Shots was released on October 18th, 1999, against The Best Man, Double Jeopardy, Fight Club, and Bringing Out the Dead. I would go on to make a little over $750,000.
It's not that bad.
It's got 11% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 27% from audiences. Got to read a little bit of Roger Ebert's review here, which is not great. He gave the film 2 stars, said Body Shot suffers from a fatal misapprehension. It thinks it's about date rape when actually it's about alcoholism. That's why the ending is inconclusive and unsatisfying. Not only does it fail to find answers, but they would be to the wrong questions. Body Shots means well and has some pointed dialogue about legal pitfalls, but it's clueless about its real subject. My own theory of date rape is that if you think you had sex and you didn't want to, but you're not sure why or how or if it happened, it's probably a good idea to call AA before you call the cops.
I want to make a point right here.
Please, yeah, please.
With this Ebert review.
Mm-hmm.
Ebert's review is problematic.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Ebert's review is
misread the film entirely.
A willful 100%. Misunderstanding yes. of what yes. was happening in the film and projecting his own, you know, yes. probably like his own like parochial sentiments onto this film
yeah.
mm-hmm. in a
yeah.
way that like, yeah, I actually do think it is a little bit about alcoholism, not in the way he's talking about, but it is mostly about male manipulation.
Yes.
Like, it is mostly a condemnation.
And just terrible gender roles and, like, all of these various yeah. well, or like preconceived notions, the societal gender
who's
roles.
Who's putting yeah, the yes, people yes, in the yes, gender roles, yes, right? Yes. So it's mostly this idea that, like, as we joked in the beginning, fucking against a chain link fence is a reasonable thing to do, like, in 1999. And by the way, like, it was kind of. Like, the thing, I'm not saying it was in real life, but, like, yeah. Yeah, I think we probably...
Well, in a film.
I think,
in
real sure. life. I think we probably all know people who in real life have had sex...
Oh, for sure.
...outside in semi-public places.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. they say it in the movie as like a proper kink, whatever. Like, preference. Yeah. It's a thing.
It's not... That in and of itself, like, isn't really a problem. It is this idea that my sense is immediately after that scene is, she didn't want to do this. Like... And there's this really bad notion. Yeah, there's this bad notion of consent the whole time because Jerry O'Connell keeps giving this idea of like, she didn't say no. She didn't say no. That was 1999's version of consent.
Yeah.
yeah.
It wasn't, it was, you have to declare no.
Right.
As opposed to declaring yes.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting thing too, that I think they understood that in the context of this film. That's
all. I think that one of my issues with this film is how straight to video 1999 it feels.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, lots of, you know, post-production slow-mo shit that looks like garbage.
Disastrous.
Lots of, I understand that there's ideas here. I'm not disputing the ideas that the film might very well be trying to get across, but if you're depicting it in such a way, you're diffusing any of the power of your arguments, which is what I think, where we're coming down, at least.
What does that mean? What does that mean if you're depicting it in such a way?
I think it's like execution dependent. Yeah. Like, I think that what you're saying, like, there are definitely those themes here. I mean, I think there's sort of a when Harry met Sally kind of thing here, looking at like how women and men, like cisgendered, examine sex and like their POVs on it at the time. Of course, this is very like broad stroke, etc., but like what they're saying, and like each character then talking about like how they've used sex versus like relationships, where like one person's like having sex in a foreign country doesn't count as sex, but like a kiss from someone you love does, you know, things like that. So like it's examining sex and like desire and pleasure through different lenses, which I think can be super interesting. And it is looking at like toxic masculinity and like the ways in which men try to like brag to show how much like they're good at fucking, like the guy talking about like how he jacks off by the gallons. But
so bad,
like those things can work in context, but I just think like the filmmaking prowess and like the talent on screen was not maybe up to the challenge of the material, or at least like the material wasn't wholly suited for proper execution. Like it just, like, well, you can see how it could be something working, also, but it just doesn't reach that point.
Is that really the viewpoint of this room? The viewpoint of this room is you could see it could, how it could be working, but you just feel like it was execution. It was poorly executed.
I have.
Okay. Cause that's my, my sense was you guys think this movie is just a sucky joke. And now there is a bit of retrofitting of this idea of, okay.
Well, I also do think it's bad.
Okay, so let's talk about that.
Well, but I do.
Because I'm not going to defend the execution. I don't like the fact that, like, when I made the face, when you said that is, yeah, we've seen so many movies do things poorly like that. We all watched a movie we are crazy about called Moulin Rouge that we all gave like 99s, and we all criticized some of the, you know, some of the very in the moment directorial choices that didn't take away from our love of the film, because ultimately movies are about feelings and emotions, and you can overcome some limitations of the time. So yes, but like when I was ready to make fun of this movie, because I thought I was going to make fun of this movie for a long time, I was putting down all the things I think are stupid, right? Like I think like the obsession with Dutch angles is stupid. I think the, you know, the poorly, you know, the overlit club and an underpopulized thing is stupid. I thought the fight between Jerry McConnell and the random bodyguard was stupid.
Disastrous.
It's actually wonderful. But like, I thought it was stupid in the moment. I thought there were so many stupid things going on. But now in retrospect, in totality, this is what I mean. Like, you do, I think, have to start to reframe your idea of what's going on as a way to view the piece as a whole.
But see, this is, I, again, this just might be how you and I just view film differently.
It's possible.
So I genuinely say that, and it's not to denigrate what you're saying, but from my perspective, you can have all the best ideas in the world. If it's executed badly by, you know, poorly directed on most levels, it ultimately hurts your argument. It makes anything you're trying to say problematic. Because, and again, like, I'm not saying that there isn't a lot of perhaps interesting ideas in this film. I think there are. I just don't think that if you can't execute those ideas and convey those ideas well, it doesn't matter.
What do you think wasn't executed well because they had some wonky camera effects?
No. I'm talking about, let's talk about
that's what I'm interested in. What was actually executed poorly?
The acting was not great. It's bad.
I think the message itself gets very corrupted as a result of a combination of poorly executed like elements of filmmaking, directing, writing, acting,
cinematography.
I think in particular the writing is like entirely not up to the challenge of trying to tackle something that like has always been a little bit of a hot button issue, like continues to evolve. Like knowing that this is not something that's going to be magically solved in 2 years. By 2001, we're all going to be so happy about the state of sex and gender roles in the world. Like to have a script that's this thrown together with like extremely broad stroke characters, like, and then not executing on the technical level. Like I think the combination is what's really the killer. And also, like,
with all due respect, what are some examples? Like, just I can talk about the movie.
I think it's like line delivery too dependent, like, or like things like that. Like, I think Jerry O'Connell, look, however we feel about him, like when he talks about like putting Alka-Seltzer on his dick and like pretending it's a condom.
That was actually Livingston, but yeah.
Oh, sorry. Either one, but like there's a way in which you can do that tongue in cheek and it's like effective, but it doesn't feel in there. Like it feels like they almost believe it.
This is where we disagree.
Here's a huge problem for me going off of that. And I think it touches on characters and acting and writing all at the same time. I get that in theory this is a movie about toxic masculinity and all that super fun stuff, but the female characters are so underdeveloped mm-hmm. in contrast to the men, because men, quote unquote, talk about sex more. Really, the only time that we hear the female perspective on sex, aside from that, if you have sex in a foreign country, it doesn't count, which doesn't have anything to do with anything in the context of that scene, is when they're playing off what the men are saying in that Ron Livingston getting a little kinky sex scene. The only time that we hear about, oh, did you know that the male prostate is actually like the female G-spot, is in, as a response to like what Ron Livingston is saying. Yeah. There's, it's not a proper dialogue. It's just like very one-sided.
Why does it have to be a proper dialogue?
Because there's no, I think,
balance to actually find
why
a balance.
Does a movie have to be balanced?
Because in order to talk about this issue, regardless of if you're coming down on one side of it, if you're not coming down on one side of it, by trying to have this ambiguous ending and really looking at like how the situation could actually unfold from different perspectives, you actually need to have different perspectives.
You need to see the perspectives.
I hear what you're saying. And respectfully, like, I don't disagree with that point in totality, like globally. But I think this came up on the Being John Malkovich podcast mm-hmm. that we were talking about. And this is how I feel pretty strongly right now in general. In Being John Malkovich, for a moment, Lottie self-identifies as a trans man. Lottie doesn't ultimately become a trans man. And there is some, or does it ultimately transition? Who knows what the intention with this character is? She ends the movie as a cis female, and we don't know if she transitions down the road. There is some discussion in that film about, well, is this poor trans representation? Is it poor trans representation to have a person declare that they're trans and then never transition? Is it done for a joke? Is it done as a, you know, is it Charlie Kaufman and Spike Jonze dipping their toe in the water in 1999 and taking it out as soon as it got too hot? What's going on there? And my feeling about this moment, which I said on the podcast and which I believe pretty strongly, is, well, Charlie Kaufman in particular, and probably Spike Jonze, but Charlie Kaufman in particular, as far as I know about this person and everything he's done, has a very specific viewpoint of his own body, which is, it sucks. Right? It sucks. Like, I hate being
maybe
in this body.
Maybe no one hates being a human more than like, Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah.
I think he hates the vessel he's in. That's
right. That's what I really think it is with him. We don't have to be a BMJ Malkovich thing, but I think he genuinely hates the vessel.
Yes.
And I think part of that is because he always has these doubles in these movies where the vessel's better.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
Vessel is always better than him. So it's like, synecdoche, it's like Paul Giamatti, but then he casts, like, you know, he cast the killer from fucking the Tooth Fairy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Who's that guy? He's a giant. He cast a literal giant.
Yes.
So like he hates his body. Uh-huh. I think over the course of Charlie Kaufman's life, he's considered maybe the problem with my body is that it's a male body and not a female body. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what he was unpacking with Lottie. But he cannot possibly go all the way to what it's like to be a trans man because he's not a trans man. My argument about this movie is, it would be great. Not even it would be great. It's a different movie that is more balanced. It's probably more of a TV show. It's something that's made more in concert with more people, more different ideas. But I think what Michael Christopher and David McKenna in particular are dealing with is, I think David McKenna, if you look at his filmography, is dealing with, God, my friends fucking suck. Mm. That's what it seems like to me. My friends fucking suck. I hate going out with these guys. I hate this weird pursuit of women in a very awkward and uncomfortable way. And I do think, like, there's this line that gets, you know, said in the movie that sex without love is violence. I think that's his feeling, which is like there's something really weird and ugly going on among us straight bros. And that's what I want to put out there. So in my argument, it's like I don't think movies require balance. I don't think any movie is balanced or can be balanced. I don't think you need to show the other perspective in an equivalent way. I do think that, like, the perspective of these guys in particular is that women are objects. And I think that's obviously gross and nasty, but I think it was wildly prevalent at this point of view, at this point in time.
Oh, duh.
And I think that of course. But what wasn't prevalent was this idea that artists should have to contort themselves into presenting something that they don't fully understand. as opposed to bringing in other people who may understand that perspective more and collaborating. But this is way more of a TV idea than it is a cinematic auteurist idea.
I totally see what you're saying. I think it's sort of like an execution dependent in like how the movie is specifically like structuring itself and like in terms of balance, because it goes out to be like a semi doc, or at least like with the cameras breaking the fourth wall and like talking to the audience, it gives you a sense of like, okay, we're seeing everybody's perspective. It sets it up like these are your, you know, main six or however many characters, right? And like, we're going to learn about like every one of them, how they view sex and like, what is their backstory? But like outside, right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And so like,
that's a problem. They're a little like, different, but they're all
the specificity. All yeah. And like, because it sets out from the beginning to be like, here are all our characters. And like, we are going to have them talk to you and tell you what they think. It like gives you immediately in your brain, you're like, these are the characters that we're going to learn all about throughout this. But then over the course of it, like you mostly get like the perspective of like kind of like two guys, you know, and like it shunts a lot of like the women to the side and like they have very tertiary like impact on the plot and things like that. So you do feel the unbalance where because the movie sets itself up in the front half to be like, we're going to give you all this balance of all
the
characters.
Also not sure what you're supposed to invest in, which is also kind of part of the problem. Like I know that the relationship between Rick and Jane seems to be the one that we're supposed to be in theory,
which
bookends the movie.
Most boring characters.
They really are boring. There's no chemistry between the two of them. Yeah. It's not great.
Are they the ones who end up on the bed?
Yes. That's the ones that start on the bed and end on the bed.
That's the best scene in the movie. It's like when they're cuddling on the bed in their clothes. I was like, oh, that is romantic and hot.
Guys.
30 seconds. Okay.
That's amazing. All right.
That's one scene.
So, yes, I think that
it ends on a good note. But
it's amazing.
As Jordan said, the film gives the illusion of balance without actually like them following through on it. Mm-hmm. And also, I would argue if this is a movie about like, damn, my friends suck and I don't like going out with them, it's just 90 minutes of setup with like absolutely no arc, which I think like that is such a crucial core aspect of any piece of filmmaking. Like, you start the movie being like, damn, these guys seem really shitty. And then by the end of the movie, you're like, wow, those guys are really
shitty.
Like, yeah, I mean, what did we learn?
Oh, there's a big difference here.
I have a question I want to pose. Has everyone here seen Barbarian?
No.
No. Fuck. No, say nothing.
I will not say anything more.
This is sorry, Jordan.
No, but like what I'll say is like, I think there's a way in which like characters don't have to go through, this is like not related, but like on your point, like the characters start out and they don't learn anything. And you think that like Jerry O'Connell might have some sort of come to Jesus moment. And there's not that. Like his friend doesn't really like him in the beginning and like doesn't really like him in the end. Like there isn't like a realization of like, oh, they suck, or like, oh, they're worse and I'm going to leave my friends behind. It kind of ends just like, well, there's a hung jury, and I guess I'm a hung friend, you know?
It should be said, too. I agree with what you're saying, but I'm not saying that you have to do that, just to be clear.
Like, no, totally.
I don't think a good movie is dictated by whether or not a character grows or changes.
100%.
I think that you can buck that trend. And I also think that you don't necessarily have to resolve this thing that happens between Mike and Sarah.
I like that it's
unresolved. Sort of, although then we have a whole trial that's off camera.
Yeah.
Sure. And then told to us. But I'm speaking of whether or not there's any sort of conclusion to this specific crime, or if it's a crime or whatever the case may be. I'm fine with it being ambiguous. I'm just saying that you run the risk of not satisfying your audience to some degree by doing that. There's a way of doing that, and that's okay. And there's lots of movies we will inevitably talk about Magnolia, and that's a movie that ends in a way that a lot of people found at the time satisfying and unsatisfying, and whatever. We'll have that discussion when we talk about it. I don't have a problem with ambiguous endings, and I don't necessarily have a problem with an ambiguous ending on this film in particular. I do think, though, because of all the other things we're talking about in terms of these characters not being necessarily well drawn, it just amplifies what can be an unsatisfying narrative, and
I think
puts you in that position.
Yeah. All right. So I think we're kind of, I don't know if we're missing each other, but I want to make this kind of clear. To me, this movie is not about whether or not a guy raped a girl, right? Like, it's just not. Like, that has almost nothing to do with it.
Actually about alcoholism.
It's actually about alcoholism. I think and then to your point, Brooke, and there's a great tradition, I think, in films. So many movies that we love of the change actually coming in the form of the perspective of the viewer, the form of the perspective of the camera,
sure.
Right? Goodfellas is a classic example where through half of this movie, it looks great. The characters don't change. The filmmaking changes.
We realize, oh, this sucks.
Some of the aspects. Fight Club is another example. Yeah. Where for Wall half Street's of this, another, mm-hmm. so many Scorsese, so many of the quote unquote,
but he only makes gangster movies,
right? So many of the quote unquote best movies are, and these are all movies that, like, frankly, we have to, you know, grapple with. Mm-hmm. You know, my friends Jordan and Mandy like have like a big issue with these movies because their argument is like, oh no, the first half of that movie actually is like the movie, like that's the sensory memory of these movies, and they're selling you on this like. This, you know, the Wolf of Wall Street life is incredible. The gangster life is incredible. Like, you can't divorce that from the films. I don't feel that way. I feel like you have to show the good in order to kind of, you know, dissect it. And I think that's what they're doing in this film, right? I think this film, and particularly in 1999, and particularly the same year where American Pie came out, particularly in the same era where, like, losing your virginity or fucking a chick or, you know, porn culture and internet culture and all of these, like, you know, this fucking Girls Gone Wild shit was so prevalent. To have that be, and the name, what a provocative name, Body Shots, right? The most sexual thing you can do in public, right? That was like publicly allowed as a body, mm-hmm. a body shot, right? And then the double meaning, obviously. To have all of these things happen in the first part of the movie in a way that seems like it's celebrating it, and then to have this truly horrifying thing where this character from, weirdly enough, American Pie, comes back beaten up, right? Like, bloody. Like, we see enough of that to know, like, whether it was a rape or whether it was really rough sex. Like, this was not a rape in the classic sense, I mean. Like, where she really was, like, you know, unaware of what was happening. Or whether he, you know, pushed things beyond the level of what she was comfortable with. Like, clearly, she was, like, abused in this moment. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not played for fun. That's not played for laughs. That's presented as just an extension of what happens in this scenario in 1999, particularly with like an aggro dude, very strong, gets in fights with bouncers and beats them in front of other people. Like these, and doesn't get arrested and nothing happens to him, a celebrity, a football player, in the wake of things like Ray Carruth killing his wife. Like, this is like, to me, this is just like, almost self-evident that they are damning the shit out of the moment in time and hating what is happening. Now, like, I think where we differ, and maybe I've convinced you guys a little bit, I hope, is like, I find this shit to be so like powerful in 1999. We've seen so many movies and TV shows from like things like that were huge at the time, like American Pie, to things that like people never really, you know, took down or really looked at closely, like Freaks and Geeks, that like that you know kind of viewed women as people to conquer sexually and didn't view them as real characters. Where something like this, it's like laser focused on the male perspective, but it's laser focused in a way that's like, no, this is the problem over here.
I think we have to think about like audiences though too. If we're talking about like in 1999, I think like where I have a little bit of an issue with the movie is sort of its tonal balance, because you start out with this, obviously, this insane quote. But then you cut to, like, 4:37 a.m., Tara Reid's been attacked. We have, like, this whole setup of, like, what's happened. But then we jump back in time to, you know, the partying and the fun. And the movie feels like it's pitched at trying to make you enjoy and, like, laugh, even though, like, you know, have in the back of your mind the tonal shift that will come. And I think that, like, it would have been more powerful if it started out with the fun and then you cut to the tonal shift, sort of like a Something Wild type situation, or like where the movie like is like, oh, as we were talking about Goodfellas, where like you realize, oh, this fun we were having is bad because this movie, the
Goodfellas starts with a guy gets shot in the trunk of a car. Like Goodfellas is going to be my counter.
Okay, I get you, but you know what I'm saying? Where it's like it feels like if you're the men that this movie is sort of trying to lampoon who would see this movie, I think that they would like relate and maybe not like they would think it's funny not actually like see the critique of it. You know what I mean?
The Fight Club issue, right?
Right.
Like it's a red flag if a certain type of person likes Fight Club. Like that.
And that's not. Yeah. I don't want to hold it against the film because I do think that. I mean, we've talked about this a lot in '99 in terms of and listen, Wolf of Wall Street was dinged with this as well.
Yeah.
People being like, is this really? It's effectively.
It's a hard argument to make that these are, to me, that these are good. You know, like I'm getting to the point where I'm like. Thinking about Wolf of Wall Street in particular, being like, no, they actually do make that look fucking great. Like, that actually, and like, it even ends with him, like, leading the fucking charge. Like, that's one that I have a little, like, from a moral perspective, a little harder time with, even though, like, I love the experience of that film.
Well,
that's,
I
think there are consequences to Jordan's arc, and whether or not hits hard enough.
He wrote a book, it got optioned to Martin Scorsese made the movie. Well, I mean, what a nightmare.
I don't think that, I think it's the. I know. I understand your point, but like to say that he didn't have any consequences to his actions, I think is glib. But I think that ultimately, this film, I think tonally, to your point, Jordan, struggles as well with the acting. I mean, yes. and with executing these roles. The only character or the only person I think that gets out of this movie unscathed is Amanda Peet.
Yeah.
I think Amanda Peet's a great actor who's always a great actor, no matter what she's in. She comes out of Simply Irresistible also unscathed. So,
well, she's a little more scathed than that one.
But I just mean in the sense she knows what movie she's in, I guess is what I'm getting at.
I agree with that.
And I think she kind of always knows what she's in. Mm-hmm. And she's very good in this film. I think that the role is a little underwritten, but she's elevating the writing in her performance. If across the board this had been cast with actors of Amanda Peet's caliber, I don't think that I'm hating on this film as hard as I am. I think that so much of this becomes so much more palatable when the characters all pop in certain ways. The problem is that it's cast so homogeneously that what you're left with, and again, this might have been intentional. I don't fucking know. I mean, maybe he wanted a bunch of flat bros to play these guys. And that was the goal, and he succeeded in doing so. But in the process, I'm left with not caring about any of them. And again, maybe that is the goal. I mean, if the thesis statement was being a 20-something in LA right now is fucking hideous and these people are all terrible and they do terrible things and you shouldn't like any of them, then the movie is very successful in doing that, in my opinion. I don't leave the film caring about any of them. I don't leave the film wanting to spend any time with any of them. And then it's a success.
I think that's what happened. I start the film
in that way too. Like that is, even if your characters are not growing and changing, and I agree with what you said earlier, Phil, that's not a prerequisite of like, you
absolutely,
can,
yeah.
Like you can film as,
so why do you, sorry, but we
as the audience also don't come away with anything. I don't feel like this movie had any sort of effect on me other than wishing that I had an hour and 45 minutes of my life back.
That's the argument I'm interested in.
Can I also I want to piggyback on what Brooke is saying, because I think that, you know, we were talking briefly about the last scene of the film.
That's where I was going to go.
And I think that the last scene of the film, which is the best scene of the film, ultimately Rick and Jane, we think that they're getting together. We think that they're finding a bridge. There is one of the worst needle drops of 1999 of some maudlin fucking emo song playing while we think that, and again, maybe intentional, right? Because like where the scene goes, it feels as though maybe it's a commentary on like, you think you're getting a happy ending here, but fuck you, you're not getting a happy ending because these two people clearly have been fucked up by what's transpired over the last 24 to 48 hours and that they can't be together anymore. And we're left in this sort of melancholy, maudlin, sort of sad moment of them lying there on this bed. It's a nice image. It raises ideas and it leaves you in a place that is legitimately interesting and yet also emotionally depressed. Like it leaves you in just such an odd place to want to leave you for the film. And again, I think that's all intentional. And I think that leaving that being the last scene of the film is perhaps the most powerful thing they could do under the circumstances. But I also feel as though the preceding hour and 40 minutes or however much is just sort of, I don't know, not particularly effective.
Yeah. Going back to, I mean, I feel like what sort of like the base argument for us, the haters, is that maybe we would care more about what this film was trying to tackle if it was a better made film. But because, in my opinion, it's very poorly made, it's there's not enough to bridge that gap between what you think it might have if it had lofty intentions, mm-hmm. and what we actually ended up seeing.
I think it did have lofty intentions. Like, yes, listening to what Kenny is saying,
definitely.
I genuinely do think that you have changed my opinion in terms of opening. Well, I mean, let's not get too ahead of ourselves. You'll still hear my score at the end, but I do think that, you know, you have shined a light on stuff that I couldn't see. And that's not to say that... Just that sometimes it's the medium, not the message, right? Mm-hmm. And the medium here is fucking rough. So you're having a tough time seeing the message.
It's callous to be like, yeah. If you didn't do it well, like, does anyone actually care? But like,
sometimes that's the case.
True.
Well, I can appreciate where you guys are coming from, but I also think that's why we do this podcast.
Sure.
Oh, absolutely. Right?
We do this podcast because... My sense is so much of film criticism is people watching a movie and then assuming that they have taken in the entire film and everything that you know is intended by it and then publishing something about it and then never changing. I think, like, in full disclosure, I read a bunch of reviews of this film, everything I could find, because I wanted to see if anybody validated my opinion. And there's one guy in the San Francisco Chronicle who kind of did. I can't remember who it was. It wasn't Mick LaSalle. It was somebody else. So this isn't entirely, like, from me. Like, this is, like, there was one guy who validated this opinion. But I do think that it's, you know, to me, critical to strip away the things that are interchangeable. Like, not interchangeable, the movable parts, particularly acting, cinematography, things that come after the script and the hiring of the director, and look at the core of this film. And it's like what I was, again, with Being John Malkovich, the reason I think Being John Malkovich remains a classic and is successful, The Matrix remains a classic and is successful, and a movie like American Beauty doesn't, because American Beauty is almost perfect in all the technical aspects of that film. Right, the acting is incredible. I watched that movie. If I watched it today, I would still be like Annette Bening, like, spectacular. Mm-hmm. Right? I think it's beautifully shot. I think the score, like, was the first time to do that Silvestri thing, so beautifully and so, like, perfectly in that moment. Was it Silvestri? Or was it Horner?
It was Thomas Newman. Thomas Newman.
Who cares who it was? That Thomas Newman thing. But it really plays. It really, really works well on a technical level, and I think that's kind of what, you know, carry people. You strip that all away and you get a really cut to me.
But I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I also just want to, because I do think, and I think I you know movie's ideas, a movie's script, a movie, what it's trying to say is not on par with the execution of it, right? I'm not sitting here saying.
But it's more important.
That's my point. Yes. Right. I think that the ideas of a film, are far more important. I think that, you know, we're all writers here, so obviously we all think that scripts are obviously the most important part, but I do think that genuinely they are, right? I'm not sitting here saying that that's not the case. What I am saying, though, is that the other stuff you're talking about, if not done properly, is going to hurt.
I totally understand. Of course I understand that's where you're coming from.
I also think the script sucks.
I was going to say, not to be bullish on this, but the script is bad.
I think the dialogue is like borderline, like, hard to sit through at times. Like,
hold on. Let me finish my point. I totally agree with you, Phil, that there are movies where the execution is such a barrier to even, you know, get into any intended meat. Most of these films,
yes,
like The Omega Code,
sure,
don't have anything to say aside from,
and
like,
they suck in terms of execution.
And they generally, to me, yes, great artists who are incapable of executing on their vision, mm-hmm, like in this filmic medium, also don't have anything interesting to say.
Sure.
This is an interesting case where I actually don't feel the way you guys feel. Like, I feel like so much, I feel like obviously everything was on purpose. I feel like, for instance, the Jerry O'Connell fight scene, which in the moment I wanted to blow my brains out watching, right? Really, like,
that's where he fights the bouncer.
forever.
Yeah.
Right?
He fights the bouncer. They live type
15
fight.
15 minutes. Yes.
Yeah. It's like live. Real time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Guys, she's right, wrapping so, fucking up.
So here, let me, and this goes to almost my original point about this film, the way films are discussed. The They Live type fight. They Live fight yes. in general. For those of you who haven't seen They Live.
Is incredible.
It's incredible. It's Roddy Piper, Keith David. They fight for about 8 minutes and they never stop. And the whole, there's an obvious joke
yes. right,
going on there.
Yes.
Emphasis on obvious.
Yes. There's not an everybody obvious joke
is,
here.
No, there eventually is.
The They Live one works because it reaches, it goes, you're like, wow, this is long. Then it's you're like, okay, this is too long. But then it keeps going, which makes it so much better. This one ends before it can reach that second.
It's not a
what's going on here.
Because that's the point I'm making. It's not the point I'm making about They Live is They Live, you know, John Carpenter, and I love that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But you're very much on the inside from the beginning. There is no question about what he's saying throughout the entire film. You're watching something satirical, you know who you're supposed to sympathize with, you understand where you are. You're very well oriented in that film. This film, this is not to me, even a fucking Fight Club type fight. This is a nasty, ugly, gross, real-ish fight where you're just like, what the fuck is happening? Why is everyone watching? This is, like, I even like point out to weird things that happened in the 90s back then that I think this was commenting on. There was a big fucking bum fight movement in the 90s where people sold videos of bums fighting. There were like all sorts of like weird fucking like violent fighting things that would happen. And I think the idea that this guy got into a fight in the middle of a crowd and it just went on and on to the point of like, this isn't a movie fight. This is a bloody gross, like nasty, like down and dirty fight where it's just like, if you're walking away from that scene being like, these are guys I'm into, and you're not like, get away from him now. And then he gets into the cab and pulls Tara Reid with him. Like, it's like, get away. It's awful. Like, I'm totally, obviously on board with this. I think this is all intentional. I think the nasty execution is like kind of a feature, not a bug.
Part of it,
I think I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I really do think that this film is about excess. This film stays in sequences too long. I think there's a whole blowjob sequence where they're just talking about blowjobs. It feels like it goes on for fucking ever. Mm-hmm. Like it's definitely a movie that is saying like, you think you want this stuff, so we're going to give you way more than you think you want. I think that that's an interesting notion. It makes me wish that someone like Oliver Stone directed this film. Mm-hmm. That would have been an interesting thing.
It's like Haneke, where he like gives you funny games and you're like, you want horror? I'll give you horror. Right. Like, I'll give you disgusting. And then you're like questioning yourself. You're like, oh, this is fucking awful. Why am I watching this movie?
I'm not a big fan of that thing, but
I think it also like,
No, I'm really not. Like, I mean,
I'm not a big fan of this. Sorry, Brooke. I'm just not a big fan of this. Like, particularly Haneke funny games notion, which is like, we are complicit. I just don't believe that I am complicit in scripted things I see on screen because I am trying to like glean an understanding about humanity from it.
Right.
You know, like, don't do the funny games thing. Do whatever you want, but like, it's not something. I don't take away what I think other people take away.
I wanted to jump off of what you said though about like, you think you want this. This is about excess. You want to see this, and then like all your expectations are, you know, are overturned. But like, there's only a very, very specific subset of the population even in 1999 who's going to want to go see this movie with the intention that like, this might be fun. I'm not saying that that is a bad thing. Movies don't have to be made for everybody. But, like, obviously I'm looking at this from a 2022 perspective. But given literally everything I know about every moment of my life as a woman that I've experienced, nothing would make me want to go see this film with this premise, with this trailer. I think only from kind of, like, this sort of, like, douchey, toxic masculinity, like, bro forward mindset are you going to walk into this film thinking like, this might be a good time.
We also need to talk about the trailer at some point. They allude to films in the trailer.
What's really important about what you said, Brooke, is no one saw this movie. Like, also true. The notion that the notion that like there is like some bro-y douchey group of people that went to this movie en masse is not true. No one saw this movie. This movie ultimately wasn't for anyone, and I would argue it's because it was neither fish nor fowl. But
I do think it was a bit of a hit on video. Like, I do think that it tapped into the Cinemax kind of thing, which is its own thing, too.
And you want to watch this alone. This
we
is
maybe
like,
can look that up. The title, like, that's like a little anecdotal. I don't think it's – I don't think ultimately people wanted this. I think the douchey bro-y people you want – you're talking about went to go see American Pie. And that's not that was non-critical about their, you know, lifestyle and their choices whatsoever. Reduced literally every female character.
I hate that movie so much.
But guys, you guys, should. Guys. It's a terrible, terrible film.
What if you fucked a pie?
You do make a great point.
You know what, Jordan? At least the pie, you know, is inanimate.
Yeah. I mean, come on.
You know, so
guys, there's a pie.
We really went to town on American Pie in our episode.
Good.
Which I think
as
still
you should.
Might have come back up. I think it's up again.
Oh, we can put it up. You know what? Even at this point, I don't think that, even at this point, I don't think Chris Weitz would defend it. Because like,
I agree with you.
He's a good guy.
Yeah.
And I don't think that he would defend it. I don't think he understood that he was Jerry O'Connell in this movie. Like, I just don't I don't think he understood that he was putting something out into the world correct. That was really, really bad.
Well, this can't be sort of underlined enough. I mean, first of all, it should be said, you guys are youths. You're youngins. You were not there when this was all happening. You weren't in a theater when American Pie came out.
But I was there for Body Shots.
But you were there for Body Shots.
I said, Mom, we're going to fucking Body Shots.
But American Pie played like fucking gangbusters.
Yeah.
It was an unbelievable hit.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, listen, I'd be lying if I said that I didn't laugh in 99 sitting in that theater because there's an infectious kind of quality to what's going on in that film. And
you were also 19.
Exactly.
And you were also 19. And like, to your credit, you didn't know everything, and right. You know more things now. Right. There is this idea that, like, I liked American Pie 2 in 1999. The idea that I was, like, of course I was wrong and somewhat, like, damaged by the media, but at least I fucking changed. I give people credit. I'll give a guy like, you know, David McKenna, Michael Christopher credit, and some of the great movies we've seen. Like, I don't think this is a great movie, but I think some of the great movies we've seen, like a Being John Malkovich, that really understood things about, you know, human psychology mm-hmm. and honesty in a way that sure. people weren't talking about in 1999. Like, you know, you get fucking a lot of bonus points.
Well, you brought this up too, but this is sort of the Fight Club thing too, right? Yeah. I mean, we did an episode on
Fight
Club.
Which, by the way, I loved.
Sure. Like, I loved it at the time.
No, I didn't like it at the time, and I love it now.
I quite liked it at the time for completely different reasons. I think I was suckered, for all intents and purposes, at the time into sort of its, you know, edgy, kind of cool, Finchery thing. I don't think that I was red-pilled by any means by the film, but I do think
there's
that...
There's a big difference. Big difference.
No, absolutely. But I'm just saying that, like, I think that I was kind of sucked into the coolness of that movie at the time. I still think that it's a very slickly made movie. But in our episode, we obviously unpack, you know, what it's like watching that film in 2021 when we did the episode versus 99, and it's just it's a completely different animal, right? Mm-hmm. I understand that when a film comes out, it can be, you know, it's when you were talking, Kenny, about how you know, this film has whatever it was on Rotten Tomatoes, like
11%,
something like that on Rotten Tomatoes. You know, Pitchfork does something that I think is interesting, which is they reevaluate mm-hmm. some of their reviews. Mm-hmm. They go back and they listen to an album again and they unpack it.
They'll actually change the review proper,
exactly.
Yeah, you
know? And I think that more critics should do that. I think that some critics do put themselves under a microscope from time to time based on social media taking them to task. But like sometimes it happens. And I do think that we should do that more often. I think that this film...
We do it every week.
We try to do it every week. But this film was perceived a certain way at the time by critics as being garbage, as being Cinemax, whatever the case mm-hmm. might be. Roger Ebert's review being utterly insane bad. In terms of his perspective on date rape. I think that in 99, date rape, for all intents and purposes, wasn't as much of a, I hate to say a thing, but I don't even think it was
this
a thing.
Wasn't, I mean, not that it matters, yeah, but
it wasn't a conversation.
It was a converse. Date rape, it was, but it was a different thing. Date rape was a very specific idea of drugging a girl.
Yeah. Correct.
Or you go out with them.
Yeah.
It was drugging a girl And it's like to call it date rape almost sounded like it wasn't as severe, but like it was drugging a girl or anybody, but really it was, you know, I think was referring to men doing it to women. When you were with them, either, you know, casually or on a date and taking them home in a, you know, in a totally compromised state.
Yeah.
This is a little different. This is, you know, look, I don't want to even say it was rape. The whole point of this movie was you're not in that room. You don't know.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to be in the perspective of someone who is like, I think something fucked up happened. But what can I do if I can't like literally prove it in the moment? All I can do, because they had the went through the whole jury trial, the hung jury and all that. That's why I love the ending so much. It's like all we can do is kind of like look inward and reevaluate like the way we're going to proceed with each other. Because like what can I really glean from like a completely broken system?
I mean, I think that that's, I agree with that. I think that ultimately the film leaves us in the, I put this in quotation marks, but the best place it possibly can in terms of the intellectual and the emotional ideas that it's trying to investigate. But at the same time, I did find it to be an unsatisfying experience, right? Like, and again, maybe it's unfair of me to approach this film that way.
You feel the way you feel, but
I just mean, I mean intellectually and emotionally, taking the actual viewing of the film out of the equation for a second. I just think that all of these pieces laid out the way that they're laid out makes it just a hard movie to enjoy really on any level.
Let's, all right, I want to broaden this conversation a little bit. Feel free to tighten it back if you guys don't want to go here. But I think this is a conversation that I'm interested in having, and I think is worth having. For whatever reason, in the last 2 weeks, I can't remember why it happened, but I found myself with a bunch of Hunter S. Thompson quotes in front of me. I think it was on some Twitter account or something somewhere. And Hunter S. Thompson has a really interesting quote that applies to this movie, which is sex without love is, I'm paraphrasing, but something to the effect of sex without love is as stupid as love without sex. Right? And I think it doesn't take a genius to figure out what he's saying there. Right? That's to me also the thesis of this film. Right? Which is sex and love have been decoupled over the last 50 years, probably from 1999, right? I think like for me as a kid, it was surprising to read Catcher in the Rye from 1949 and Holden was actively trying to fuck without trying to fall in love. I'm like, oh, so this has been going on for a long time, right? Like this idea, you know, way before my parents like quote unquote fell in love and had sex. So,
quote unquote?
Yes.
Oh my god!
I love the idea that my mom is firing up the body shots episode, and she's gonna get mad at me for this. But okay, so the last 25 years, the decoupling of love and sex has been the default position of young people, progressive people. Everyone, I think, right? Like, I think to me, there's a fairly easy demarcation point. It's the Bill Clinton trial where progressive people on Clinton's side had to say love and sex are two different things in order to move forward morally, you know? What do you guys think?
I think that they are two different. I don't think that they have to exist together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the classic, speaking of classic quotes, everything is sex except sex, which is power. Like this idea that like it is always about a little more than like the intimacy, and like love and sex have been decoupled forever. I think like now there's certainly,
but not in a way that people knew it and accepted, not in a polite society kind of.
Now there's certainly more of a kind of like you're making a statement if you were like consciously decoupling them. But I also think like a lot of it is this sense of trying to separate the gender roles that are like really clearly laid out in body shots and being like, if I'm a woman and like my male partner is going to quote unquote date rape me anyway, like if there's a chance of that, like what is, you know, why should I feel like love has to go hand in hand with sex when I can look at sex the way that men have been looking at sex for millions of years? And by men, I mean, like, you know, the patriarchy, male society, whatever you want to call it. And like, by doing so, how do I, as like, you know, a more underserved person, gain some of that power? Because it like, at the end of the day, I do think it's about, like, there's an element of power to sex, particularly like in the context of something like body shots, that you can't divorce, like, from the cultural conversation or from like the actual text of the movie.
It was always interesting to me, and I want to keep going to you guys, but just commenting on what you said, it was always interesting to me, it always is interesting to me, that the men, to me, when there was a more, and I say this like relatively speaking, relative to now, a more patriarchal society.
Yeah.
There was this idea, and there remains this idea, that, you know, casual sex, sex, you know, aromantic sex, was more of a masculine idea than a feminine idea. And part of this, I guess, third wave of feminism was like this idea of, oh no, it's something we want to. Right? It was something we as women want as well.
Yeah.
Is it? Like, I don't know. I mean, like, I know that's like, that sounds glib and mm-hmm. But my question is like, because I come from it from a, you know, male perspective, which is like, it's not something I ever wanted. So it's not something I really intellectually understand. Like, I kind of, I certainly am not someone who, I don't want to get too deep into my sexual proclivities, but basically it was always romance.
This is the episode.
It was always romance and sex were hand in hand to me. Right. And we're always like, the goal is not to just fuck. The goal is to have sex with someone you love.
You care about. I think that what I have really appreciated about like how the conversation around like sex and casual sex in the past 20 years has evolved is that we seem to have reached a point where we can acknowledge that one sex does not like the act of sex more than the yes. other. And I think that like it lets society as a whole look at casual sex as more of an individual thing
sure.
than a gendered thing. Men want casual sex, therefore you as a woman have to be blah, blah, blah. Women want emotional intimacy, therefore you as a man have to. It's more about like...
individual basis.
Yes. Yeah. You should find a partner who thinks about sex and love and their relationship to each other the same way that you do. Mm-hmm. And you can't paint like in these broad strokes. Like it's very, very individual. There's a huge spectrum of like what people like in sex and like...
Yeah, I mean, I would argue as well that another weakness of this film is the fact that I don't feel as though it really shows the spectrum of sex.
Oh,
that
it not is. At all.
And I don't even mean, and again, I don't mean to sort of project something onto the film that it didn't necessarily want to do, right? You were talking earlier, Kenny, about how very specific this film was in terms of the voice of it, and I don't disagree with you, but I do feel like from a sexual proclivity perspective, I'm not talking about having, you know, the entire spectrum of sexual activity in the course of this film. I don't think that that's a fair thing to ask of it, but, and again, it's a 99, so it's all a bunch of fucking, you know, right down the middle white people, so like that's naturally. Its own thing.
Well, and I think which is also mm-hmm. because I think it's so critical of this culture,
yeah,
that this saying particular
in of itself,
this particular yeah. white cis culture mm-hmm. that you, I don't think you can kind of ask for broad, you know, for broadness because it is criticizing something very specific and very pervasive and virulent in society.
I mean, again, I you know, we've talked about this for 5 years, Kenny, in terms of intent, right? We can only assume intent. We can only assume what this film might or might not have been saying. And that's why we do this podcast to examine those things. So I don't know what the goal of this film was. It's possible that the sort of very specific, narrow perspective it had on sex was intentional. But I did find myself just feeling like, it was just so fucking, like the sex was so boring for the most part. Like we have obviously this one, again, again, that might have been an intentional thing.
I think that's his point.
But it feels like it gets murky when you have the whole, like, yeah. Emily Proctor dressing up in this S&M situation. Like, it feels as though it's just, like, that to me felt like it was making fun of those sort of proclivities, mm-hmm. which I think is
definitely
which is
was,
a bummer.
And it was meant to be a little comeuppance for this character who comes by the gallon.
Sure.
But
you understand what I'm saying, right? Like, I do think that there was an opportunity to do something more.
This is, this, but this gets back to like my original point, which is mm-hmm. instead of taking a survey of sexuality in 1999 and presenting all these different things, it takes a narrow focus and presents a very specific and cogent argument, which is, I'm going to be generous and say sex in 1999 among young people is broken. And I really think it's actually what he has Brad Rowe say in the movie, which is sex without love is violence. I really think that's what he is trying to say. Now, the point I really want to make is, like, it doesn't really, to me, it doesn't really matter if I agree with that perspective or if I don't agree with that perspective. What I really am kind of taken by is the fact that such an unusual stance is taken in a way that I didn't ultimately find troubling. It's a stance that I think is humanitarian and is a genuine attempt to make the world a better place in a way that I don't think is exclusive, which I think it is kind of big-hearted. And while it doesn't encompass the whole thing, it's almost impossible for anyone to encompass the whole thing. What I think it does is leads to conversations like this that are really rich, where you can say, right, well, it doesn't really apply here. It doesn't really apply there. It doesn't really apply to 2022, or maybe it does. Mm-hmm. But in the moment, like, people weren't saying that.
No, I agree with that.
It's contrary to, like, what the media was putting out there on a minute-by-minute basis, and it's compelling.
I think that I absolutely agree that this movie is an example of its time. It's a product of its time, for good or for bad, mostly for bad as far as I'm concerned. I do think that you're right, Kenny, that at that time, this was what we were being fed. And that's why, and again, might be a commentary on that. Who knows? I think that I was just sort of surprised for a film that was sort of wearing sex on its sleeve in the way that it was, you know, even just like, you know, obviously you alluded to it at the top of the podcast, this sex scene that we have in this open space, public space, chain link fence, shot like a Cinemax movie with this, you know, slow-mo and all this sort of stuff. And again, that might have been a commentary on those things.
But
I don't know.
Everything can be a commentary on anything. That's the thing, is that it's like, I don't think that, although, like, I really, really respect the point of view, and I feel like I do have more insight into this movie now. I just, because a movie endeavors to make a point, doesn't mean that it gets brownie points, in my opinion.
To me, it does. But to me, it does. But, like, but more to the point, like, I just, you know, the where I differ with you guys is I think it makes the point pretty well. The movie that I want to bring up in terms of another movie that Phil and I both watched for another podcast that very much deals with sex and the way it's commoditized in the 90s is Showgirls.
Good movie.
That's
a great movie.
Really unlocked the
Showgirls. Showgirls is an incredible movie. We both love it, and we lauded it on our Razzie's best. You know, our Razzie screen draft. It was number two, and it was basically, you know, could have been number one. It's one of the best movies.
Was it number one?
No, Freddie Got Fingered was.
Oh, yeah.
my apologies. Yes, Freddie Got Fingered was. But I almost wish Showgirls was, because it aspires to something greater.
Yes.
Showgirls is also a movie where, you know, a lot of things that were quote-unquote... Now, it's Verhoeven. I'm not saying Mark Christopher is fucking Paul Verhoeven.
I was going to say, to me, it's like Verhoeven seems like he knows what he's doing. Christopher does not...
So much
like
of that, yes. And I think, you know,
Esther Heads might not know what he's doing, but that's neither here
nor there. The man is on too much coke to see straight.
That's works in the film.
He's just hitting keys.
I'm convinced that's the exact opposite of, like, this movie, even though, you know, where I think this was a pretty incredible screenplay that was kind of, you know, deflated a little bit by its direction, where Esther Haas's screenplay is sounds like the ravings and rantings of a weirdo pervert.
In the best way that possible. Was.
Yeah. No, but I agree. The Verhoeven turned it into a mass
elevates, which is what he does every time. Which he's like, well, like he gives. I think he instead of looking at a screenplay from a guy who could write, Strauss can write.
Of course.
So instead of looking at a very highly competent screenplay and pointing out all the ways it's fucked up and dramatic, he is able to elucidate the ways in which that speaks to our moment. He did it with RoboCop. He did it with Starship Troopers. He did it with Showgirls. I think that Showgirls also in the moment suffered from a lot of the same criticisms that we're hurling at this movie now, which is the acting is bad. It's not. I think her performance is legendary, but truly legendary. But you have to want the movie to start looking at Elizabeth Berkley in that film and being like, all right, so like you knew exactly what you were doing with all of this shit, and you're really playing up this idea of sex kitten, this idea of femme fatale, this idea of women's roles in these type of movies. You're playing up the idea of hysteria. The idea that her performance was fucking shit on. It's so upsetting to me. It ruined her life and career.
Yeah, I want to also just
say, Jordan. Well, real fast, I can see he's been dying to.
No. The thing is, like, you're making good points, and just thinking about this screenplay, like, I don't know whether it's just because it's Esther House or something, and whether it's Verhoeven's direction or the actors being so cued in, but like. Some of the dialogue in, Basic Instinct or this, like, he got off before he got off, an incredible line. But then you hear something like this where he's like, my dick looks like a chew toy, where there's, like, not enough knowingness, it feels like. It's like a half step removed from being so aware of what it's doing. And I don't know whether that's because Esther House was a fucking psychotic madman.
No,
it's just a most likely writer.
Right. No, right. And no. I think like
it's,
that is,
it's because Verhoeven's an incredible director.
Exactly.
Well, I wanted to say that because I'm glad you brought up Verhoeven, because I think it's worth unpacking. I think and this piggybacks on what both of you were saying, because Verhoeven is a very explicit filmmaker. Lots of sex in his movies. He makes sex so fascinating and weird and scary and sensual and all of those things. Right. I would argue that there might not be another filmmaker who explores sex as brilliantly as he does. This makes sex so fucking awful and boring and like gross
because there's no love.
Not good awful. Like you feel like you're engaging with the material. I think boring is the best word to describe it.
Yeah. Again,
everything is shot very flatly. And again, like we said, sure, you can say it's shot flatly because X, Y, and Z. And that is the whole reason why we do like podcasting and stuff like that. I'm not saying that you're saying that. I'm saying that it's like that's an argument that could be made. But at the end of the day, what really matters is that shooting it that way is entirely.
Well, what's interesting too is that Christopher is a filmmaker. If you look at his credits, right, he's got that movie Original Sin with Antonio Banderas and Angelina Jolie, and Witches of Eastwick. He is into the idea of unpacking sex in somewhat interesting ways. It's just he seems to be better at it when it's a little more dialed up, when it's a little bit more, complicated or just whatever the case might be. It's not that he's not interested in exploring these things, and I'm glad that he wants to try to. I just think that this film just
I think he's very much disillusioned by where sex has the turn sex has taken in the 90s. Just in terms of Verhoeven versus Christopher, I mean, I'm not really comparing the two. What it seems like, and this is very much me, kind of projecting onto these films, is Verhoeven has an uncanny ability to either get his actors to understand his vision or cut around it in a way that it works. Yeah. It's crazy. Because like in Starship Troopers, we know that they thought they were delivering it straight.
Yeah.
Right? My sense with body shots is that these characters were either told too little or too much. Right, I can't really figure out whether or not they were like told, play it straight. It's a it's a 90s movie. It's a 90s like romp, like so many shitty horrible movies that say nothing that we've seen this year, or whether they're like what we're actually doing here is dissecting and flipping what happens in all the movies. So I want you to play it like that. But I don't think that there was any, again, Color of Night-esque, any Color of Night-esque, like, oh no, what we're doing here is something you've never seen before, so play it like you're nuts.
I think, like, you look at his filmography, though, and, like, Bonfire of the Vandals, like, like, that's also a satire, but it's also so deeply unsuccessful, and that one has a good director behind it. So, like, I...
Quote, unquote.
You really...
You don't like De Palma?
Oh, fuck. For some reason, I thought it was...
I was about to, like,
For some reason, I thought it was... For some reason, I thought it was Schumacher. I don't know why
Hey.
I know.
Hey there, sir.
Excuse you.
Yeah, we love Schumacher. I love De Palma... Yeah. Except when I hate him.
Yes. That's like half of his filmography at this point now because he just, all of the shit that he did. But I think it's like, I think that's emblematic of like this film where it like, it has a satirical aspiration perhaps, but like no matter what, if it's like a good writer or a good director behind it, I just don't think that maybe Christopher is up to the challenge that he has set out for himself. And so he's just kind of fallen on his face.
It definitely feels like he's... really struggling.
Yeah.
Let's rate this.
Yeah.
Let's
great film.
Move on with our lives.
This is the best movie I've ever seen.
Jordan, do you want to go first?
Oh, God.
Or Brooke, do you want to go
first? Brooke.
Sure, so this is the percentage scale.
Yeah, 0 to 99.
I'm going to give this,
Here's the question.
Yes.
0 to 99 before this podcast? And 99 after. Yes. Because Kenny made some very valid points.
Now listen. This is going to sound harsh, and this is in no way...
way harsh, Ty.
This is in no way, I want to make it very clear, a reflection on Kenny's argument, which I thought was incredibly well-researched very well laid out. If I was grading a paper with which you laid out this argument, I would give you an A.
Appreciate it.
B plus.
However, she's not.
I do not think that it personally changed how I feel about the movie. It gave me additional perspective, but I don't think that that perspective, actually made it through. Okay. So, but I will say, before the recording, I would give this movie, like, a 10. I hated it. I found it very, very hard to find any redeeming elements. I would say after, I'll give it a 25.
Go ahead. 25 is pretty good. 15 points is good no matter when you
can get it. Yeah, that's 15 points of thoughtful discussion on love.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Sex and the 90s and macho masculinity.
Guys, we've done a lot of movies together now.
And it didn't even make a million. So this I feel really sad.
Jordan, you go ahead.
I was trying to do the math in my head, like what a half star on a 5-star scale is. So whatever,
it's a 10.
Yeah. So I'm going to start out with a 10 as well. I'm sorry.
You guys.
I'll go up to a 25 as well just to agree with Brooke. Because I can't be too mean. But I feel like we didn't even dig into like like I wish I had this script in front of me so I could just like page by page be like
lines in this movie that just make you want to crawl.
It's not like disastrous.
But how is it? How is it not about?
I'll tell you. I'll tell you.
No, God, I'm sorry.
I don't want to know.
I'll tell you. This is. Well, Entourage is a pretty horribly written show. The lines are often horrible and embarrassing. Except when they came out of the mouth of Jeremy Piven.
I thought you were going to say, except when they came from my mouth.
That would have been stellar.
Except when they came out of the mouth of Jeremy Piven, who had a uncanny ability. And that's there are other people who could do that, like remarkably Emmanuel Shrieky could do it as well. And drama, but we were better at writing him, I think. But Piven in particular had an uncanny ability to turn shit into gold. So I do
Ari Gold?
Into Ari Gold.
Yeah.
I do think that in that the script and lines like we're talking about could have been delivered in ways that we would not be so
We did talk about
the fact that like, you know, casting this movie differently could have elevated.
Coulda shoulda woulda. I don't think that the lines are clearly worse than some of the worst lines or quote unquote worst lines in Showgirls. They're just delivered as part of a piece that I understand what he's working with. So
Well, since we have you guys, obviously, where does this fall on the queer quadrant?
Half star. I would give it a half star specifically for maybe one star for a specifically mention of the prostate as
correct. There is mention of the prostate
pleasure dome
because this was. I feel like you want to talk about like 90s cultural moments. I feel like that's such a. Did you know that if you stick shit up your butt,
I mean, fucking stick shit. Ron Livingston in this movie, the character of Trent is fucking.
He
bonkers.
Needs
what
this,
is he?
Yeah.
Doing
he's lucky, very lucky that
this movie.
Because he's lovely and I love him and almost everything he does and it's his worst saddest performance.
Really not good.
He totally missed it.
So I didn't see this film in 99. Before this podcast I was at a 25. That's where I started from.
That seems that's what I expected from a reasonable person.
And Kenny did move me up to a 39. So I mean I do think that this I would never recommend anybody to watch this movie. but I do think that If I'm trying to find some positives, I'll say that like I think Amanda Peet is really really good in it. I think that
you wouldn't recommend people to watch this movie.
No,
guys. Okay,
you're up.
I'm up. Let me tell you my journey with this.
Would you actually recommend this to people?
Are you over a 50 on this?
Of course.
Oh,
God. Would I actually recommend this to people? Did you not hear me through this entire podcast?
Well,
This is a really interesting movie to discuss.
Here's a better question for you. How would you recommend this movie to someone? Would you recommend it with context? Would you just say throw it on and then call me? Like, whoa. How would you?
No, I would.
How would
that's
you
a great
set
question.
Up
that's a great question. I would
people to watch
never
this.
In any world recommend it and say just throw it on. You'll like it.
Yeah,
ever.
I think that's kind of telling. Just
well,
saying.
Would you do that with Fight Club? I mean,
yes.
Like,
yes,
absolutely. Because Fight Club is a well-made movie.
Yeah. I would, if honestly,
you wouldn't recommend Fight Club with context.
No.
Good for you guys. In 2022, an alien comes down. And you're like, watch Fight Club. No.
Well, I would have a lot of other movies I'd recommend to an alien first. But
every
like,
movie. Same with me. But every movie.
This is the first.
Every
movie,
movie that you recommend to someone. With the exception of movies with incredible twist endings, I think you have to have some kind of context. My context with this movie would be this movie is the anti for I would recommend specifically to a person who is skeptical of American Pie and say you want to see a movie that does something similar but the exact opposite, watch Body Shots. And then I think
with the double bill of American Pie and Body Shots
as long as you present
no one goes to that screen.
Well, no, the scary thing about the double bill is to me is people would think they were, you know, the same.
Yes.
But they're not.
Correct.
So as long as you present it as the yin and the yang of two things, then I'm down with that.
Okay.
Here's my journey with this film. As this movie ended, and I was truly blown away by the end, like 99% of films would have had these two have romantic sex at the end
of this movie.
Yeah. This movie did not. They had the woman cradle the fucking man. Like, just recognize how bold that was. Okay.
This is nice to be spoons. This That's
is,
right. Yeah.
It is nice to be spoons.
We all like to be the little spoons.
Yes, but, of course it is.
Where are you landing?
Being the little spoon.
You have me on
edge. But I have to give you my journey.
Okay.
Love this movie at the end. Gave it a 77.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Before this podcast, I was like thinking about it. And when you were sending the GIF, the GIF. And I'm just like, God, how could I even like ride for this? Like, I'm going to make my like intellectual arguments, but like this movie definitely falls in the 50s zone for me, though that I have explicitly said, but is for noble failures. It is for noble failures that that I do think are interesting films, but I don't think did its job. So I gave it a 58 before the podcast. I went from 77. I'm like, what am I doing? Who am I trying to be? And I went down to 58. And I'm not going to do the thing you think I'm going to do. I'm not going to go all the way back to 77 after the podcast.
You're going
to
go at 69. Just to really drive home.
I'm going
to
go at what this movie means. I'm going to go at 67, which is the big
spoon. Oh my God, but you were
the big
so
spoon hugging
close.
The little spoon. No, I'm kidding. I'm only going to go up to 59 because I do think this film really belongs. Like when I explained the 50 zone on being John Malkovich to Mark and Adam. Yeah. My point is like they're like the 50s are where like interesting movies that don't do its job perfectly should lie. And that's what I think this film is. A really interesting movie, worthy of discussion. Certainly not a movie that you know fulfilled its potential or not a movie that executed in all its goals, but like this is not a movie that you should like throw away it by any sense.
Put it in the trash, but that's just me. I'm
shocked.
I second the trash.
All right,
If people, after this
discussion came away thinking that these three want to put it in the trash, go ahead. You weren't like
here's what I'll say. I'm
39 is not that bad.
I know it's fine. I'm just trying to be a shit disturber. I think I don't think it's a good movie. I wouldn't recommend people seeing it. I agree with your assessment of the 50% sort of. You know, area. It just didn't work for me.
Hey, doesn't work for everyone.
All right. Y'all thought this was going to be a really quick, breezy episode to tack onto the end of Crazy.
I knew that this would be
before Crazy.
Oh, great! Well, you have
Crazy
so much fun.
Crazy
Alabama is a good chaser.
You guys like Crazy Alabama? Crazy in Alabama with this?
Yes. Even though Crazy in Alabama is like a fucking,
I think it's a worse movie. But I think
it's a deeply horrible movie.
What works in that movie? I found more entertaining.
Yes.
Than this.
It also just
entertaining,
I mean,
is a good word.
It's also executed in a way that, like,
it's slightly higher.
Again, like,
caliber.
It's just the below, like, the line.
One of the
on
worst
it.
Motherfucking right. movies we've done.
I don't like it. I didn't like it.
No. Didn't they solve racism or something in that
yes,
movie?
Yes, yes.
Come on, guys.
And Lucas yes. Black isn't it.
There's yeah. two movies.
Yeah. But yeah. I would argue. I think what you said is correct. Worse script, better execution, more entertaining.
So you think that Antonio Banderas did a better job directing that film?
He's doing.
He's trying to do on Motivar.
Discount on Motivar. And it works.
But listen, guys, if nothing else, guys, that's a great tee up for people to stick around and listen to our Crazy in Alabama.
Yeah,
episode.
Listen to Crazy in Alabama. Apparently, it's good.
I don't think
these
it's not.
These people
not
love it.
Good.
These people love it.
If you want
it's in my top four on Letterboxd.
I don't even know that I gave it a higher rating than I did Body Shots. I'm just.
I don't think you could have.
I don't
but
think I did.
I think,
I'm
think these two may.
I'm looking it up just because I'm curious.
I don't. I'm sure I did, but that was also. You know, I wasn't as comfortable with you guys.
I gave Crazy in Alabama 25 before the podcast. I don't know where I landed,
I gave it
25 seems generous.
You know what? Pre-podcast, it's actually lower than Body Shots. Started at 35, ended at 30. So, like, I'm not saying that Crazy in Alabama.
No, I didn't think
movie.
You were. I didn't think you were because it's not. There's nothing to talk about instead of all the ways it sucks.
Crazy in Alabama is not. They're not saying this either. Brooke and Jordan aren't writing for Crazy in Alabama.
No, definitely not.
They're just saying
Kenny,
do not. Kenny's making
sir.
The
yes, sir. Yes.
But at the same time, I think that there's a competence to the actual production of Crazy in Alabama that Body Shots just doesn't.
I'd rather watch that movie again because it's almost like a fascinating disaster versus this, where it's just like an uncomfortable.
Also, Melanie Griffith is. It's Melanie Griffith. Like, she's, at least she showed up. She gave it. Anyway.
All right, guys.
All right.
I'm gonna go watch Body Shots again. All good right. movie.
Talk to you later. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Podcast like it. You want the podcast like it.